You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Tamika Drew. She is the National Director of the Liberty Tree Foundation. We've had some other great guests from that organization in the past on Talk Nation Radio, and they have a terrific and very relevant website, timely website, this week, nomorestolenelections.org, which has a voter bill of rights that I recommend everybody read. Tamika Drew, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Talking about stolen elections seems to be Donald Trump's area in the corporate media, and talking about rigged and corrupted elections seems to be isolated to him. But what you mean by it is not exactly what he means by it, I think. Is that right?
That's right. He's trying to take our work away from us, right? But we still have a lot of work to do. When I originally heard Donald Trump talking about the possibility of a stolen election, and especially when he started using that verbiage, it really made me think about a wolf in sheep's clothing, for one, about just because you're saying that an election is going to be stolen doesn't mean you are not trying to steal it, right? So that was really my first, you know, thought about it. And of course, the way in which I see Donald Trump trying to steal the election is by creating voter intimidation, or calling for voter intimidation, and egging on violence from his supporters and his fan base. And it's become more really than a spectacle. I mean, you hear about it in the media, talked about as a spectacle and in entertainment purposes. But, you know, as a person of color, when you're going out to the polls and you're going and you know that there are very real white supremacists waiting for you there, unhappy that you're going to be casting a vote, it doesn't matter if Donald Trump is behind in the polls. All of a sudden, you're feeling like no matter what you were going there to cast your vote about, whether it's a proposition, whether it's a local election, you feel worried. You feel like your right to vote is being called into question. And I think that as far as democratic culture, that's something that in this election is really being affected and kind of being called into question. What are we building? What do we accept as a part of our democratic culture when it comes to elections and how we view election fraud and stealing elections and the right to vote and voter suppression?
I know that we at RootsAction.org and you guys at Liberty Tree Foundation are planning to set up a petition that people will find at RootsAction.org to the Justice Department on this. But what else can people do between now and the election and on Election Day? What should they look for? Who should they report intimidation and other abuses to? How can people remedy this immediate problem?
Yes, that's a great question, David. And it's interesting because we've never really needed to prepare for something like this. And the way that, you know, when Obama ran for president the first time, we saw a little bit of this going on, but nothing like what we really think will be in store at the polls. So this petition calling for the federal government, for the Department of Justice to step in and protect voters, make sure that voter rights are protected at the polls, especially in targeted areas, poor areas where people of color, where students are going to be voting. You know, specifically, he's definitely been focusing on Philadelphia. I know that's going to be an area that we need to think about. We definitely need to be diligent in the way we think about how we go out to the polls. We need to be taking handwritten notes and accounts of any voter intimidation that happens. We need to think about how we can mobilize ourselves in groups and make sure that people feel safe traveling together to the polls this year. All of these are really unfortunate things to think about, but when we have the very real threat of violence, we need to be taking precaution the same way that, you know, women have to take precaution when we walk down the streets, unfortunately. It's kind of a similar culture being created. The voting section of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is kind of who specializes in this and who will be investigating it and who definitely you would want to complain to. And they actually have an election complaint report online that you can easily file even from your phone after you're done voting. So we can, and then also at voter assemblies, we can organize voter assemblies in your local area. You can get more information about that at the nomorestolenelections.org website. And at those voter assemblies, we can talk about the voter intimidation that happened and get the accounts and kind of start to put the data together. And with this data, we can decide what we need to do, what the next steps can be after the election. If there's a massive amount of voter intimidation at the polls, it's definitely bound to affect different elections, not just the presidential election, but there are other things on the ballot and other races that are going to be contentious, that those, you know, really need to be looked at, and we need to make sure that we're working together, you know, with lawyers and with organizations who have been working on the front lines of this for many elections past on the different remedies, depending on exactly what happens on election day.
So maybe people should go in groups to vote, and maybe that would boost turnout rather than shrinking it. I don't know. But it seems the smart way to get pulled over by a police officer this day, at least if you have a certain kind of skin, is to live stream it on the internet while it's happening. Is that useful? Will you be told to put your camera away?
I'll tell you, one of the tools that I've been working on putting together right now is a group of resources for voters, because it's different in different locations. So some places you're able to take video and audio of what happens inside the polling place. Other places you are not allowed to. And so there are several organizations who have taken it upon themselves, a couple education institutions as well, students who have taken this on as their thesis in different times, to really find all of the different especially for videotaping and audio taping at the different polling places all over all the different states. So we will also have that as a resource coming live on the website, working to hopefully have that live this week. That's definitely one of the strategies, is trying to know exactly what can take place in your polls, in your polling place. One of the interesting news bits that came out last week, I believe, was the Texas police officers who were wearing the pro-Trump hats. The thing that's chilling about that is the fact that in Texas, where this happened, the only people who are allowed inside of a polling place with a firearm are police officers, and they're allowed to have firearms whether they're on or off duty. So, in essence, if someone were, you know, if you're a police officer in Texas and you decide to listen to Trump's call to go and talk to every single person of color that comes out, make sure there's no bad hombres who have voted twice, you know, one of those people could be a firearm-wielding police officer, and they're allowed to have it in their holster there. And I just think that these types of issues are really dangerous, and they really bring up a lot of issues, especially for voters of color. PTSD, everything that's happening. You know, you have police officers shooting people dead daily, and I can definitely see it happening for voting. You know, there's in the minds of black and brown people in this country right now, I think there aren't very many surprising things happening. So it's definitely scary, to say the least.
We're speaking with Tamika Drew, National Director of the Liberty Tree Foundation. So correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe you have some information on this, but this phenomenon, this feared phenomenon of people voting twice, is actually virtually non-existent, whereas the phenomenon of people being intimidated at the polls and people, particularly people of color, showing up and discovering that their name is no longer on the rolls, and at best they can vote on a provisional ballot that's likely to get tossed out or forgotten or not dealt with for a week. These are actually real phenomena. Is that accurate?
That's exactly accurate, David, and it's being reported every day, the actual data behind these numbers of voter fraud and extra voting that really doesn't happen. So we know that those are false flags. We know that that's not a real reason, but there always needs to be some kind of an excuse, you know, to go out there and to have something to do, and clearly this is just this story, this entertainment that is being spun, and then we, you know, have this as this obviously false reason that isn't backed up by any data. However, this is the first election where the Voting Rights Act has been gutted, and everybody's been talking about that, but it brings in this extra element of the fact that we're going to have, you know, less federal election observers there due to the fact of what happened with the Supreme Court and the Voting Rights Act in 2013. So we're going to have less people who actually are supposed to be there and know what they're doing and are there in an official capacity to say, hey, this is the type of intimidation that was happening. This is the type of voter suppression that was happening. This is what we saw. A lot of those people aren't going to be there. So what's the recourse? You know, we're really hoping that, you know, in some way, everything's got to shift. We know that the electoral, you know, part of our democracy is for the people, and we have to start taking a little bit more responsibility. So in the ways that we can, we have to help each other, help our neighbors who we know are being targeted and who might be affected, and figure out ways to best protect each other and ourselves and our right to vote. Because, you know, if you're able to vote, if someone in your city or in your town or in your state is not able to vote, there is not a democracy. We are not living in a democracy when that is what's happening. And I think everyone agrees with that. So we have to find a way to work together. And unfortunately this year, one of those ways is to figure out how to document and fight against voter intimidation, racialized, violent voter intimidation.
So I want to ask you about the machines, though, because for many years now, some of us have, of course, been pointing out that these machines are black boxes and there's no way to verify what goes into them, what comes out of them. It's a matter of faith-based vote counting. You just hope they happen to be counting the votes accurately, and they're very easily hacked and manipulable. So the more skeptical or paranoid, perhaps, that you are, the more you worry about elections being stolen in that manner, as well as, you know, 18 other ways in which voting is suppressed or manipulated. But only in recent weeks, only since it became something that could be blamed on Donald Trump / Vladimir Putin, have we seen all these mainstream corporate news reports about just that you can't, you know, that there's no verifiable way to count the votes with these machines, except that you weren't supposed to care about that. You were just supposed to get mad at Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. What's the reality here? I mean, is there something to be concerned about, whether or not we've learned about it from some alleged Russian hacking? You know, is there a real problem here?
Right. Well, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think that there is a problem, and you're right that nobody thinks about really the depth of the problem until there's some kind of interesting excuse to think about the problem and somebody to point a finger at. But the fact of the matter is there's no reason for us to think that any kind of ballot gets counted right now, whether we're, you know, no matter what kind of ballot we're casting, whether we're casting a paper ballot, whether we don't know how that happens. It's not a citizen-run, open, you know, type of a process where the ballots get counted. I mean, we cast a ballot, a partisan election commissions have oversight of this. We don't know what happens. Stuff goes into the ether, and we're totally hands-off about it, and we just have to have this faith. And what we're learning now with all of these leaks and all of this information is that, you know, our faith clearly we don't have anything to have faith in. There are so many different ways in which, you know, I've never been one to think that the ballots are currently being counted. And one of the only ways I think we can even begin to get towards a democracy we can believe in is to have overhauls and system change, like what we're calling for with the voter bill of rights. But with these, you know, with the machine and computerized ballot mechanisms, there's so many different ways these things could go wrong. If it's hooked up to the internet, it can obviously be hacked by anyone. And even the ones that are not hooked up to the internet can be manipulated in different ways. Of course, any kind of computer system can. But I think where we really need to focus our energy as a movement is definitely how we can infuse more citizen oversight, where we can infuse more people-led and transparency and openness to the process and to, you know, the ballots being counted, because there's absolutely no reason why we can't all be kind of tallying up the votes. There are plenty of ways that people do this all over the world, and they have more robust democracy in their elections than we do. Unfortunately, there's been a couple studies that I've read that have come out recently that do not rank us number one, not even in the top five of electoral democracy. So clearly, we need some help. We need to be looking to some other places for help.
Well, you do have a great voter bill of rights drafted at nomorestolenelections.org that includes a right to vote that can't be taken away, but also a remedy in terms of the vote counting. I mean, you would count publicly paper ballots, am I right?
That's correct. And that's really the only way we can know how things have turned out. Can we really trust, especially now that government is so owned by corporations, are we really going to trust that those corporations are going to count our votes and then tell us what we've decided? Citizen public counting of paper ballots, every single person gets a ballot, every ballot is counted, is simple, and it's really the only way. And any time we have this secrecy or these ways that things happen that we're meant to not understand, we know that there's a problem. That's not democracy. That's not how we're supposed to be set up. You know, that's not for the people anymore. That's serving something in someone else.
Yeah. And every single person, I think, is a key phrase there. There are, I think now you may have more recent figures. I think we're up to maybe 5 or 6 states that have made voter registration automatic in some way, whereas we're around 40 states that have made military draft registration automatic. So you can grasp where our priorities are as a people. But in most states, you're not registered unless you jump through a bunch of hoops, and if you're convicted of a felony, there goes your registration, or if you change your address, you lose your registration. I mean, it need not be this way, right?
The bureaucracy behind voting is really sad. It really, you shouldn't have to do, so certain states require affidavits. You have to sign affidavits to be able to vote. Certain states, you have to have a specific kind of an ID, which may be difficult for a lot of people to have. There's no reason for that. Every single person should be able to cast a ballot and have their right to, you know, put in their ability to decide. And if we don't think people should be able to do that, we need to stop calling this a democracy. We need to start figuring out what exactly this is. But if it is a democracy and it's something that we're trying to continue to build and weak and make more robust, we need to make sure that every single person has the right to vote, and it's easy to vote. Even things like having to ask for a day off or ask for time off to be able to go and cast your ballot, that is very limiting and suppressive for many voters. You can't just take time off on election day. You might lose your job if you do that. So making Election Day a national holiday where every single person, no matter what you do for a living, you have the ability to go and cast your ballot, you know, voter turnout would be higher, and we would have a lot easier of a time all around.
When you say every single person, just to be a little more specific, do you mean 18 and above? Do you mean citizens? Do you mean residents? Do you mean felons? Do you mean tourists visiting the United States? Who's in there?
Well, yeah, every voter.
So
definitely, the Voter Bill of Rights calls for enfranchising ex-offenders. It's definitely not fair for anyone to, being convicted of crime, not being able to vote, is absolutely unfair. Even people who live within Washington, D.C., within the District of Columbia, aren't allowed to vote. So, allowing them, I think they should be able to vote.
Well, they can vote. They just can't vote for a real representative in Congress because they aren't a state.
Well, and that's a big part of it. I mean, you have to be able to understand that everyone is equal when you're going out there and you're casting your vote. And when you feel like something is limiting you, when you feel like you're living in Puerto Rico and you don't matter as much as everyone else in terms of your electoral democratic rights, that's not okay.
Yeah. Another reform you have in the Voter Bill of Rights, a nonpartisan election commission. What would that be?
Well, I mean, it would definitely mean that you wouldn't have what we have right now, which means that ballots are impossible to get on because we have certain states which make it you have to collect a certain amount of signatures, so many thousand signatures in a certain way, and then different companies can get involved and make sure certain signatures of yours are invalidated, so you're not able to get on the ballot. We really need to make sure that no matter who's in charge, they're not in charge to be able to make sure their political party is able to get in. We need to have, different kinds of people being represented when it comes to the electoral commissions, and also when it comes to the debate. Not being able to hear everyone who is on the ballot that you're able to vote for is preposterous in this country when we have so much access and so much of an ability to be able to share information, to keep certain politicians off the stage because they're not a part of the parties that are in charge is very undemocratic.
Indeed. Another reform in the Voter Bill of Rights, ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting. This is on the ballot for people to vote for themselves in the state of Maine and in some localities that I'm aware of this election season.
That's right.
To create this reform. But what is it briefly for people, and then how would it help?
Well, instant runoff voting is basically a situation where you get to choose a ranking system. So you wouldn't just cast one vote. You would say, this is my first choice, this is my second choice, this is my third choice. And then they tally that all up to decide kind of until one candidate receives a majority, the counting continues. So we wouldn't have to have this lesser evil type of a thought process. We could say, we can vote with the way that we see things, and we can see how everything falls. And doing instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting, proportional representation voting, is not a new concept at all. It's not something that is difficult to understand. There's countries that are doing it. There are cities that are already doing it, like you mentioned. I'm pretty sure there are a couple cities in California that are doing it. I know San Francisco does it. Australia does instant runoff voting.
Yeah,
I think it's a great idea, especially considering we have third-party candidates right now in this presidential election that a lot of people want to know more about, and a lot of people would love to support, but they feel like they can't in some instances because of the way that our system is set up.
It seems, though, that the real corruption of our elections, even if we fixed all these other angles and we got rid of gerrymandering and we got rid of the Electoral College and 18 other reforms, it's the money. I mean, it's bought and paid for. If you don't have tons and tons of money or you aren't willing to take orders from those who do, you just can't participate as a candidate. How do you fix that?
I mean, we absolutely have to repeal Citizens United. You know, we cannot have corporations being people, and we can't have money being speech. It's definitely something that sucks the ability for us to have a working democracy just out of the running, really. And we're not going to have equal access while we still have corporate control of our elections and really of our politicians at this point. So yeah, definitely we need to make sure that corporations are not seen as people. And I think that solving that problem would definitely do a lot. But we need to make sure that we have public financing available for candidates. We shouldn't be having the corporations being able to just buy politicians and then in turn, you know, buy positions.
But sort of have it available on a scale of some decades back, or absolutely ban private spending and make the elections fully publicly funded?
Well, I think full public financing would be what we really need. We see what has happened. We see how things have escalated. Now, I think the only way that we can really have fair democracy for the people is to make sure that we have public financing. We'll always have people that are limited and unable to, and ideas that are limited if we are constantly having to rely on corporations and the free market to come in and throw money and fund the good things that we need to happen.
And so are we looking at either a different Supreme Court, a Congress with a stronger backbone, or a constitutional amendment? Or is this something we can start at the local and state levels? I mean, how do you fix a broken system from within a broken system?
You've pretty much rattled off all the possibilities there, haven't you?
I hope not. I'm hoping for something else.
I'm hoping for more possibilities. And I think that there are. I mean, and I think that's really the answer, is that we do have to approach these problems in many different ways. I know here in California it is up as an amendment to the Constitution for corporations not to have speech and to repeal Citizens United. And I know that it's definitely something Congress can do, but the more and more we talk about it, and I think the more pushback we can get from people and the general public and the understanding of what's happening and why, the more we can, you know, put pressure on our politicians and the people that we are electing into office.
It's something we're going to have to keep working on. Tamika Drew is the National Director of the Liberty Tree Foundation. The website you want to go to for information you'll need on Election Day is nomorestolenelections.org. Also, check out rootsaction.org for a petition to the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Tamika Drew, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate journalists rely on the First Amendment, but it's increasingly unclear if the First Amendment can rely on them. The relative disinterest in the impact of spying on activists, a practice with a long and disturbing history given new power by technology, is the latest example. The Center for Constitutional Rights and the racial justice group Color of Change have filed a lawsuit against the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security after the agency's failure to provide information related to government surveillance of organizers and protesters in the movement for Black Lives. Programs and policies that endanger rights of assembly and of free speech, as well as giving the truly troubling impression that law enforcement see lawful, peaceful activists as tantamount to terrorists, especially when they are black or brown. We'll hear from Brandi Collins, campaign director for media and economic justice at Color of Change. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. We often note how corporate media seem to have a near fetish for bipartisanship. Anything that both dominant parties agree on must be good, whether the people they are tasked to represent want it or not. On healthcare, for instance, most Americans say, and have said for years, that they want a universal program like those that have been successful in other countries in guaranteeing care and holding down costs. But the leadership of the two big parties don't want it, so thinking about it is silly or worse, according to their corporate media mouthpieces. That's one example of taking bipartisanship to an anti-democratic conclusion. Another arrived with Washington Post stalwart Robert Samuelson's October 23rd column, suggesting that, quote, "To bring this nasty and bizarre campaign to a meaningful conclusion, what this country needs is an outburst of ticket splitting. Republicans should vote for Hillary Clinton, and Democrats should back Republican House and Senate candidates." Close quote. That might sound counterintuitive, he wisely notes, but he says it would make a statement that neither party deserves complete victory. His support is a recent poll in which only 40% of respondents viewed Clinton positively and just 29% felt that way about Donald Trump. Why that would mean people should vote for congressional Republicans who themselves have a 20% approval rating is not clear. Samuelson's argument that you should vote for a GOP Congress to show that Clinton does not have a, quote, compelling agenda, close quote, and vote for Clinton to show that Republicans' control of Congress does not, quote, signal the popularity of their political philosophy, whatever it is, close quote, because to do that would avoid misinterpretation. Well, that's itself hard to interpret. But his upshot is that divided government driven by ticket splitting might actually produce better government. That's, he says, because Clinton, House Speaker Paul Ryan, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell are all transactional politicians. They want to get things done, as well as fierce partisans. This is the Mitch McConnell who declared, one would have thought infamously, that, quote, "the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president," close quote. It's true he didn't get that thing done, but not for lack of trying. Paul Ryan wants to get something done, namely, based on his budget numbers, to defund the entire federal government, aside from Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, and the military. Samuelson has a wish list attached to his pining for a revitalized centrist politics. Quote, "There's a huge backlog of undone legislative business, immigration, corporate tax changes, military spending, climate change, Social Security and Medicare, to name a few, close quote. Well, to choose just one, it's good to know that on climate change, Samuelson is no longer sniffing, as he did in 1997, that, quote, it's politically incorrect to question whether this is a serious problem that serious people ought to take seriously, close quote. But he still should know that Paul Ryan says, I don't know whether humans are warming the Earth's climate, and I don't think science does either. He does say the government can't do anything about it. And Mitch McConnell has said, for everybody who thinks the planet's warming, I can find somebody who thinks it isn't. His own position, I'm not a scientist. But these are the people that Samuelson suggests will get something done about climate disruption, if only we'd have the sense to make sure they don't lose control of Congress. Setting up his argument, Samuelson notes, quote, at its peak in 1972, ticket splitters represented 30% of voters, close quote. Well, why would 1972 be the peak of ticket splitting? As Fair's Jim Narikas notes, while the parties on the presidential level had definitively switched sides on civil rights by that time, with Democrat George McGovern an ardent advocate and Republican Richard Nixon pursuing his Southern strategy, congressional representatives throughout the South were still overwhelmingly Democratic, mostly the same people who had been resisting civil rights for years. So it made sense for people who missed segregation to split their vote between Nixon and their local Democrat. What makes much less sense is Samuelson presenting that era as the good old days. While elite media wait for the protesters resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline to go away so they can return to presenting their own chin-stroking as what it means to take climate change seriously, independent media continue to fill the void with actual coverage. You can go to TheIntercept.com to find video from journalist Jihan Hafiz from North Dakota, where the Standing Rock Sioux and their allies continue their protest. Hafiz reports that after a morning of prayer, protesters were attacked by police who used pepper spray and beat protesters with batons. She writes that dozens of officers, backed by military trucks, police vans, machine guns, and non-lethal weapons, violently approached the group without warning. As protesters attempted to leave, the police began beating and detaining them. Several women were targeted and dragged out of the crowd. Among the arrested were journalists, a pregnant 17-year-old, and a 78-year-old woman. Once jailed, Hafiz writes, she and others were refused phone calls and received no food or water for 8 hours. Women were strip-searched, two fainted from low blood sugar, and another had her medication taken away. On her release, Hafiz was told, your camera is being held as evidence in a crime. That crime, of course, would be journalism, and it's hard to believe law enforcement would feel so cavalier about treating it that way if more reporters would actually commit it. And finally, quote, apparently we're supposed to sympathize with the giant conglomerates AT&T and Time Warner. They're so beleaguered by changes in their core businesses that their only path to survival, so they say, is a merger valued at $84.5 billion that will keep their fleeing customers corralled, close quote. Well, so says the LA Times' Michael Hiltzik, not the only commercial media reporter to write about the latest looming merger of media behemoths, but one of few to be unequivocal about it. Hiltzik cites the Comcast-NBC-Universal merger as another case where the vaunted benefits to consumers were wholly imaginary, as well as the deal before that and the one before that. Indeed, when it comes to media concentration, everything old is new again, which is one reason we thought we would just have another listen to the leading force in calling public attention to the phenomenon, the late journalist and media critic Ben Bagdikian.
If you control the gate to the only well in town, you can charge whatever you want, or you can deny access to whomever you want. And if you have a water company that distributes water in the community, you let them in, and you then have something like a monopoly, and you can have the dirtiest water at the highest prices, and there will be very little choice. And so that's the problem, is that a monopoly or near monopoly permits you to control the quality, including downward, and control the price, including upward. We do know that after General Electric bought NBC, that at one point when there were some stock ups and downs, the head of General Electric, Mr. Welch, called the head of NBC News, Larry Grossman, and said, I hope you are not going to have anything on the news that will affect GE stock. So we've already had a demonstration that a big company with many interests, including nuclear power and so forth, own a news outlet that they are very conscious that what the news says about them, the owners, can have an effect, and usually have not been loath to try to control it, either by individual items or getting rid of an executive in charge of news who doesn't remember that one hand washes the other in corporate life and a broadcasting operation washes the hand of the owning corporation.
That was Ben Bagdikian talking to Counterspin about media mergers in 1995. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The civil rights director of Oregon State Department of Justice has filed a lawsuit against his employer. It seems the department got a new computer program that lets them search social media. And to test it out, they looked for hashtags related to Black Lives Matter and activism against police violence, turning up a tweet by Arias Johnson, which led his colleagues to start compiling a report on him without his knowledge. Johnson's lawsuit claims racial discrimination and a hostile work environment for engaging in protected activity. Well, the vivid irony at the core of this story might be that it all began because one of Johnson's tweets included the logo of the group Public Enemy, and one of his white colleagues mistook the black man in crosshairs as a police officer and wrote to his supervisor that Johnson might be a threat to police. But it's also a good illustration of how the targeted use of surveillance technology can be a threat both to civil rights generally and to black people exercising civil rights in particular. Joining us now to talk more about the issue is Brandi Collins. She's the campaign director for media and economic justice at Color of Change, the online racial justice organization. She joins us by phone. Brandi Collins, thanks so much for joining us on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Color of Change, along with the Center for Constitutional Rights, has just filed a lawsuit against the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security about surveillance of the Movement for Black Lives organizers, but it certainly has broader repercussions as well. What, first of all, do we know about what kinds of surveillance there's been? What are we talking about here?
You know, I think the kind of scary thing about it is that we don't know the full extent of it. Most of what we have right now is anecdotal stories. So part of the reason why we started engaging in this work is not only because us at Color of Change and some of our colleagues had, you know, different experiences that they weren't certain, okay, is this surveillance or not, but also directly things that we were hearing from people in the field that are on the ground. So we were hearing stories of activists being followed around grocery stores and being referred to by the police by their social media handle, not their name. We heard of movement leaders being sort of preemptively identified and arrested before events, hoping to kind of like chill the atmosphere of the event. And we've heard of multiple attempts of the police blocking attempts to live stream aggressive police behavior through use of technology like Stingray, and also working hand in hand with Silicon Valley companies like Facebook to pull down live streams. We've heard of people being stopped at airports, and I've even experienced this myself, my bags being searched through literally every time I'm traveling to D.C. in a manner that can't be random. And then also we were hearing stories of people's phones being tampered with after they were being arrested, often for like pretty low-level crimes, like maybe jaywalking or something at a protest, and their phone was confiscated and tampered with and then returned to them. And so we were hearing all of these things happening across the country in a way that didn't feel particularly accidental. And so we started investigating both the activities of the police department, but also putting in these FOIA requests to see what Department of Homeland Security could find, what the FBI could find under the FOIA Act, and would often hear from them. Like, we've had a number of FOIA requests in that have either been rejected or they said, we can't disclose this information because this person may still be being investigated, about actual activists. So after being blocked at every turn, we finally decided that it was time to file a lawsuit.
Yeah, and the contentions of the suit include, you know, what you've just touched on, the idea that this kind of surveillance, some people I've heard say, well, it's not exactly illegal, you know, but it does broach the law in terms of your First Amendment rights and also Fourth Amendment rights. And it just seems there that there are a number of points that might be made. But what does the suit itself, you know, what are you saying the problems are legally?
Some of it, as people said, they may think is not illegal per se, but we maintain that some of it is. So, for example, one of the things that we put a FOIA request in is on use of Stingray devices. And for those who may not be familiar, Stingray devices are, it's a device about the size of a suitcase that police are using nowadays that can vacuum up all the data on your phone. So sites you've gone to, your emails, people you've called, all of this information. And every time it's deployed, it can sweep up all of that information off of 10,000 devices at one time, all without a warrant. And we found that in places like Baltimore, it had been deployed like 4,300 times since 2007, in that it was being disproportionately deployed in Black communities. And so to us, one of the things that we've maintained is that this is, first of all, this is digital stop and frisk. It's more scary. So it's already running into constitutional issues, not just chilling First Amendment rights, which is also important, but that it also, we believe that use of those devices violates the Communications Act. And one reason why is because there's a study out there that says that every time this is deployed, it actually blocks 911 calls so that people are not able to call for help, mm-hmm. which we think it means that this should be monitored at a higher level. So not only do we have these FOIA requests in, but we also have a notice in with the FCC where we've called on them, the Federal Communications Commission, apologies, where we are calling on them to take action as well.
Right. Well, some of this I know is based on some work that was done by George Joseph for The Guardian and The Intercept that talked about the monitoring, you know, and it was interesting because when you talk about, we often talk about there's the law and then there's enforcement. And one of the things that was revealed was that it wasn't monitoring just Black Lives Matter protests, for example, but also a breast cancer walk and also candlelight vigils, but only in predominantly African-American neighborhoods, you know. So it's not just everything. Well, I want to ask you, what about the role of Facebook and Twitter themselves? We're talking about, part of what we're talking about is the monitoring of social media, but social media companies have some role in that. And what has that been today?
Right. It's so funny you say this because we actually have a number of campaigns right now that we're running, which folks can find at colorofchange.org, around Facebook and Twitter and their relationship with these companies. One of the things that's recently been turned up by ACLU in Northern California, who we've been working with, is that Twitter has had a partnership with Geofedia. We also, one of our FOIA requests that came in, found that they reaffirmed that they have a relationship with Media Solar, but these like companies that is market themselves as being able to target, track, and give police, law enforcement information about activists based on their social media accounts and sort of touting the relationship that they have with Twitter and Facebook. And so it never ceases to fascinate me how we have kind of leaders in Mark Zuckerberg and in Jack Dorsey who constantly go out and talk about how much they care about the movement for Black lives. We know that this 21st century movement has in some ways been powered by these platforms, and they know that as well. And so they continue to benefit off of Black pain, as one would say, yeah, without actually doing anything to prevent Black folks from being targeted by law enforcement, in fact, having a relationship to make that easier, or doing anything about, for example, the online bullying that many of these activists also endure, which is another issue we've been working on.
Well, it wasn't a coincidence that the lawsuit that Color of Change and CCR filed about FBI and Homeland Security surveillance, that that came on the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party. There are certainly analogs, of course, between the Panthers and the movement for Black Lives, but there's also this thing called COINTELPRO, and it seems as though it's almost an unbroken legacy. I wonder, what would you tell listeners or have listeners know about the connections between, you know, history and today?
Interestingly, I've been reading this book, News for All the People, written by Juan Gonzalez and Joe Torres. And one of the things they talk about in the book was that when Fred Hampton was being assassinated, and a lot of research has shown now that the police and the FBI were working hand in hand to target him, and that it was in fact an assassination by the government against a leader in the Black Panther movement, they actually worked with AT&T to cut off all the phone lines so that nobody was able to call in or out of the house before they went in. And in fact, that became a moment which led to the discovery of COINTELPRO as it exists. And once the government was kind of like called out and publicly shamed about this, they quote-unquote dismantled the program. But I feel like what we're seeing right now in a level of surveillance, how that's being used, some of the technology, so for example, facial recognition technology is another thing that we've FOIA'd and looked into. And it turns out that 80% of the people in the FBI facial recognition database don't even have a criminal record or any interaction with the law. It's disproportionately targeted and used and deployed in Black communities. And it also is not good enough technology to accurately identify Black folks. So they misidentify Black folks at a significantly higher rate than other groups. And so when you look at all of this and you see all the ways in which technology is coming together and this line between mass and targeted surveillance is being erased, particularly as it pertains to communities of color, what you see is actually scarier than what was happening in COINTELPRO. There's a clear through line in how the government continues to act and chill movements for justice, but I think where we're heading now is something that could be even worse than what was experienced 50 years ago. And so we filed the lawsuit on at this time, not just to kind of like remind people of where we were, but also what could be coming on the horizon if we don't act now.
It's very important to say, you know, when you look at the documents, you see law enforcement referring to activists as threat actors, you know, and these terms that are very much associated with terrorism. And, you know, when it's Martin Luther King Day, everyone talks about protest, and it's this American value, your ability to protest and to speak your mind. When people actually do it, we get a different kind of vibe. And what we're seeing, it seems, is this equation of or conflation of protest, you know, legal, peaceful protest with crime and with terrorism, you know, and we can see that from law enforcement, but I worry when we also see that in kind of the public conversation, the idea that it's okay to monitor protests because they are somehow threatening, you know, inherently. And that seems to me like that's this core conflict about what do we really value? Everyone says they love the First Amendment. Just don't try to exercise it, it seems.
Right. It's fascinating, right? Because even when we talk about it's so interesting to hear people talk about MLK today with this like level of reverence, and they say things like, well, if Martin Luther King was alive today, he would never stand for this. And conveniently forget that when Martin Luther King Jr. was alive, he was called by the FBI, you know, the most dangerous man in America or one of the biggest threats to our country. And that's how he was treated. And he had a huge file on him, as did Cesar Chavez, as did a number of people in the environmental justice movement and the second wave of feminism. And so what we've seen throughout history is the role that the media has played when convenient in forwarding a police PR narrative that reinforces the need for surveillance in our community and conflates safety with surveillance in ways that I think everybody should find alarming. And so you take a movement now, the movement for Black Lives has been very clear, you know, that they are for freedom, that what they're talking about has nothing to do with killing police or terrorizing our community. And yet the fact that police officers across the country are being trained to see these activists as terrorist threats speaks volumes.
And then just finally, we keep saying, well, it's chilling. And I think it's important sometimes to spell out what that means. There are people who will tell you they might protest. They feel strongly about police violence, for example, or war, or frankly anything. But they are concerned that if they go out into the street, that will mean, you know, that basically a file will be opened on them, and maybe that will impact their ability to get a job or get a mortgage or things like that. And they're not really off base to think that. So when we say chilling, it really comes down to an individual level.
It doesn't. It doesn't. Like, I think the thing to remember about it is that, again, that line between mass and targeted surveillance is extremely blurred, particularly when it comes to Black and brown folks in low-income communities. So, for example, the majority of the buses across the country are equipped with audio and visual surveillance technology. And we know from stats about public transportation that overwhelmingly the majority of the people that take public transportation are people of color from low-income communities. So they're coming under the microscope. If you're in a Black school or low-income community, there's chances that there's school employees or security guards that are walking around wearing body cameras. And some of our work by our partners at Muslim Advocates has shown that a dizzying level of surveillance takes place in mosques. And we know, looking back historically, that a lot of surveillance during the civil rights movement took place in churches where a lot of organizing was happening. And so this false narrative that our actions trigger surveillance, when in the reality our identity is often what's triggering surveillance, I think is a thing to keep in mind. And it doesn't have to be that way is the other thing too. I think what we're fighting for, and part of the reason why we do the work that we do, is because we believe another world is possible. I have a friend that often says, you know, once upon a time people smoked on planes, and it never seemed like there would ever be a day where you couldn't smoke everywhere. And some of that changed because we saw that it was a danger to our public health. And I think that's the same case that we're trying to make around the way surveillance technology is being deployed in our communities, and that we do believe that there is another option on the other end if we act now.
We've been speaking with Brandi Collins. She's campaign director for media and economic justice for the group Color of Change. You can find them online at colorofchange.org. Brandi Collins, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Coastlines known for centuries are beginning to merge inland. Streets flood even without storms, and the surge from each hurricane seems larger than the one before. According to early reports, Hurricane Matthew set new storm surge records in many parts of the American Southeast. None of that is news to our next guest. John Englander is the American oceanographer who literally wrote the book on rising seas. It's called High Tide on Main Street, now in an updated edition. He's been the CEO for the Cousteau Society and International Seakeepers. Englander founded the Rising Seas Group to advise governments, industry, and communities. But John Englander also has a degree in economics. He can speak to the developing financial costs and social rearrangements we either make or will be forced to make. John Englander, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Glad to be with you.
When it comes to rising seas, can we say that all of us are witnessing the birth of a new age?
Absolutely. In fact, it's hard to see it because it is so new. For 5,000 years, sea level hasn't changed much because the planet has been in a fairly stable climate regime. But when we look back millions of years and see the ice ages, we realize that climate did change naturally. But now we are broken out of that natural cycle without getting into detail, perhaps. But the fact is we are entering a new era after about 5,000 years of stability. And seas will rise. The ocean temperature is warming. Currents are changing. Temperatures, rainfall, all of that.
In the first edition of your book, you predicted the kind of damage that hit New York and New Jersey with Hurricane Sandy. How did you know?
Well, what I was describing was a scenario for what would happen if we had a superstorm that happened to come up the North Atlantic and head toward the Northwest and would happen to hit in Atlantic City, New York, and just to describe the kind of mega damage. The fact that that happened 1 week after my book was published surprised me as much as anybody else, frankly. I wasn't predicting it would happen then. I was describing scenarios to begin to help people see the future. A number of others have also happened that I described in my book as scenarios. But, you know, if you understand the physics properly and can look at the big picture, we all realize that to some degree we have a pretty good chance of our forecast or our scenarios becoming true. And Hurricane Sandy was just an extreme example.
It's early days, but did Hurricane Matthew fulfill your expectations of higher storm surge?
Yes. Again, my expectation is to really step back and look at the big picture and say the ice is melting, the seas are rising, we've got more heat in the Earth system, we've trapped it in the ocean mostly, and so the oceans are warmer. So we're going to get new currents, we're going to get more evaporation, which means more moisture in the atmosphere, which means heavier rainfall events, and these are going to manifest as these kind of strange storms or weird weather, as some people prefer to say. And Matthew was an example of that. We're going to get these record-breaking temperatures and record-breaking storms and out of the pattern. And we need to get used to the fact that weather is going to become abnormal. In fact, abnormal will be the new normal. And Matthew was an example of that.
What's the role of the hotter ocean in these storms?
Storms, whether it be a hurricane, it's moving heat. And if you heat the oceans and the ocean currents change, and the air currents, like the jet stream changes, as has been happening more and more, it produces weird weather because our weather pattern, what the temperature will be, what the rainfall patterns will be, all came about because of fairly stable ocean and atmospheric currents. And we know that if we put a pot of water on the stove and we turn up the heat, we can see the currents in the pot changing. And the same thing's happening with the ocean. It's hard to predict because the oceans are several kilometers deep. We're seeing the Gulf Stream move a little bit and slow down a little bit. We're seeing the El Nino currents in the Pacific. All of these things are changing outside of their normal boundaries because we've cranked up the heat on the pot, the giant pot that is the world's ocean. So all of that does connect. And, of course, the evaporation comes as you warm water. You get more evaporation, not boiling, but just evaporation. And that comes down as heavier rain or even snowfall. And we're seeing that.
So could you take a little time and describe for us the slow but determined process of the ocean reclaiming land in the United States, for example, or if you wish, in other countries?
Sure. Again, we've had a fairly stable shoreline for about 5,000 years, which is pretty much human civilization. And the height of the ocean determines the shoreline at a macro level. And so the amount of ice on land, not the floating ice around the North Pole, which is floating sea ice, but the ice on land, which is from Greenland and Antarctica, is where 97% of it is, and then all the glaciers from Alaska across Canada to the Alps and Scandinavia, that's the ice on land. And the height of the oceans reflects the amount of ice on land. And normally this changes in a roughly 100,000-year cycle, with the oceans going up and down about 120 meters or almost 400 feet. We were ignorant of that because we happened along at the turning point between the up phase and what would have been the down phase as we entered a cooling period. But we've changed that. We've heated the oceans, and we are now melting more ice on land, in the first case Greenland, and then the glaciers all over the world. And the next to follow will be Antarctica. And it's a long-term trend. It's unstoppable now. We can try to slow it, and we should. And we also need to begin adapting to parts that's now inevitable.
So, John, this summer you traveled by ship to Greenland. Tell us about that. What was the purpose of the mission, and how did you get there?
Actually, we traveled to Greenland by airplane. Then once we were there, we went on helicopters and on ships. The purpose of the trip was the commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Admiral Paul Zukunft, had me do a keynote or a briefing for all of his admirals 8 or 10 months ago. And the more he thought about it and we talked about the phenomenon of rising sea level, he realized that the U.S. Coast Guard had to be prepared for what was going to happen by mid-century. And that, too, he wanted to see firsthand this case of what's happening with the glaciers in Greenland, because icebergs are becoming more prolific as the glaciers melt, counterintuitively. And also that the melting and opening up of the Arctic seaways presents more shipping traffic, which is an issue for the Coast Guards, and potential environmental issues from oil spills and accidents and collisions with icebergs. But also that the opening up of the Arctic is why the world's weather is changing. So Greenland or the far Canadian Arctic are great places to go and look at that. So the commandant of the Coast Guard organized the trip and brought me along as his climate expert and met with his Danish counterparts to try and understand this, so that the Coast Guard was always prepared, which is their motto, looking ahead decades into the future.
So do you think Greenland melt will happen fast enough to affect my listeners, the people living now, or are we talking about something for future generations?
Well, let's think that if a generation is 25 years or so, your listeners now, many of them will live past the turn of the next century. Or some of them will, not maybe not your listeners, but certainly into the year 2050, 2075. And in that time frame, in the next 40 to 60 years, let's say, which covers two generations, and that would include your listeners, I would presume, that we are going to see sea level rise. In fact, it has just started, but it's just started so small that it's hard to notice. But Greenland will probably produce somewhere between 30 centimeters, or that's a foot, and double that, maybe triple that this century. The problem is Antarctica has seven times the amount of ice as Greenland, and therefore seven times the potential sea level rise. And the big potential change is how far the melting of the West Antarctic glaciers proceeds. That's the big question mark. We don't know whether we're going to get a meter or 2 meters from Antarctica this century. And we won't know because predicting an ice sheet's collapse, and this is ice that's 3 kilometers thick, 2 miles thick, is kind of like predicting an earthquake or predicting an avalanche. If you're up in the mountains, and we've all probably been there, and if there was enough snow precariously on the top of a mountain, they might tell us there was a risk of an avalanche. But they can't tell us when, just like we can't predict when an earthquake will happen. Well, the problem is that the 3 kilometers of ice on Greenland and bigger quantities on Antarctica, they're showing signs of early melting, and they're showing signs of collapse. And so we don't know whether we're going to get 30 centimeters, 50 centimeters, that's a foot or a foot and a half, or 3 times that in the second half of this century. But here's the reality that I always conclude for every group that I talk to, and whether it be corporate or larger audiences or conferences, we need to do two things. We need to slow the warming as quickly as possible, working on greenhouse gases. But even if we were 100% successful, even if we could bring greenhouse gases to zero today, which we can't, but if we could, we'd still get sea level rise. So there's no time to waste to start building higher. We know that sea level's been higher before. It's been lower. We know it's going to be higher decade by decade, century by century. Now is the time to begin planning for higher sea level.
Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the famous American oceanographer John Englander. We're talking about the arrival of a rising ocean on land. Well, your TEDx talk in Boca Raton, Florida was well placed. John, isn't Florida on the front lines of this onslaught of rising seas in America?
Yes, it is. And I happen to live here, which is why I did the local TED talk when it was here. But the fact is, Alex, you know, we really need to get out of our minds that this is just a Florida problem. And you're based in Canada. I was in Vancouver, not too far from you, last week. I was in Toronto a few weeks before that. I was in Prince Edward Island before that, in Nova Scotia. But every country in the world, from Bangladesh to London, Netherlands, to Singapore, Shanghai, Mumbai, every place in the world that's on the coast, and it's worse in places where the elevation, the topography is low, and, you know, doesn't climb too quickly. So Florida there is, of course, a good example, but Vietnam and Bangladesh are even worse, and more tens of millions of people in those places. We've got to realize that as sea level rises, it's every coastal city in the world, and it's not just cities on the coast, it's those cities on tidal rivers. So that would be up the Fraser River in British Columbia, that would be the St. Lawrence Seaway, that would be the Thames River in London. Cities from Sacramento, California to Hartford, Connecticut are 80 miles, 120 kilometers inland in the United States. They're vulnerable to sea level rise. We've got to really open our minds and realize that the shoreline is determined by sea level. And they've both been stable for about 5,000 years, all of human civilization. That era is gone. We should do all the good environmental things. We should certainly try and reduce greenhouse gases to slow the warming. But the third thing we've got to do is begin to adapt to higher sea level, which is now unstoppable, and it's not limited to Florida.
Do you think Miami will eventually go underwater?
Eventually, and so will the Florida Keys and parts of the Bahamas, and so will the islands in the Pacific and Indian Ocean that people fear about, the Maldives and Kiribati, and so will parts of British Columbia. And so, and again, will Miami? Yes, and it's iconic, and people think about it, and it probably has a more economic value at risk than any other city. But even if it happens over the next 100 years or so, and the flooding just gets more and more frequent in the meantime, again, we would do your listeners a disservice if we said it's a Miami problem. Because the fact is, it's a New Orleans problem. It's a Annapolis, Maryland. It's a San Francisco Bay. It's the truth is, every coastal country in the world.
You talked about the financial angle of this. You have studied economics. Right now, currently, coastal real estate is the most expensive, but according to the science, many of these homes and businesses will become first uninsurable, then worthless, and then maybe gone. Could this trigger a financial implosion worse than the 2008 housing crisis?
Yes, but the difference will be that a financial crisis can happen almost instantly as soon as there's a realization of a problem. The growing awareness that sea level is rising will be a slower phenomenon, and the decline in property values will be slower, both because the realization and acceptance or the denial disappearing will happen over years or decades. But on top of that, sea level can't suddenly rise. I mean, I hate to say it, the good news about sea level rise is we have time to repair. The good news is it can't happen quickly like a tsunami or even a sudden storm like Matthew or Sandy, but it's unstoppable. And the sooner we wake up to that and realize we have to begin slowly adapting, the better. And I think real estate values will do the inverse. I think they will slowly begin to decline, realizing that coastal real estate has a finite life as the sea rises and the shoreline tries to move inland.
And what about the economic cost of having to replace ports or big infrastructure like Boston's Central Artery Tunnel or the Big Dig or New York's subways? Can any country really afford this?
Well, the answer is none of them can and all of them will. Even that sounds counterintuitive, because the truth is there's not enough money in the world to compensate people for the land that will go underwater. No government, not the United States, not Saudi Arabia, not China, could afford to make everybody whole with the new realization, which most people don't even have yet, but hopefully your listeners are ahead of the curve here, with the realization that sea level is permanently going to rise many meters. So nobody can afford that. Yet the reality is this isn't like an option, like should we have a preschool education or some kind of subsidized health care. If the ocean wants to be 1 meter or 2 meters or 3 meters higher, it doesn't matter what we want, and we will find the money to either move out of the way or build things higher or put in pumps or adapt to it. This is not optional.
As you know, our world is heavily influenced by big corporations who straddle borders all over the globe. John Englander, are big companies looking into the problem of changing oceans and have any contacted you?
I would say it's the early stage. Several have. I can't name them. Part of my being retained to help people think this through strategically is they want to be able to do it without it being public. So I have to sign non-disclosure agreements, as you'd imagine, and also with national security interests that are trying to look to the world of the future. But it's still the early stage. I would have to say that I've been doing this now for 6 years, I guess. I started writing my book 8 years ago. My book came out 4 years ago, 2012. And year by year, the awareness and interest is growing, but it's still early stage. For most businesses, to think beyond 5 years is kind of over the horizon. But if it's framed well, if we explain to people that this is inevitable, and that now is the time to plant the seeds for future businesses, for future communities, for estate planning, for strategic planning of how the world will change when the ocean is, again, 1, 2, or 3 meters taller, moving the shoreline in many kilometers in some cases. It's a disruptive idea. There are a few leaders, but year by year, the interest is expanding quickly.
Well, I'm hoping eventually, and it may be a tipping point, that comes out of the shadows and everyone says quite openly, yes, we're planning for this because it's obvious. Now, you've proposed intelligent adaptation. Can you give us an example?
Sure. In my book, High Tide on Main Street, as you cited, I've come up with what I call the 5 points of intelligent adaptation. One is to act with a long-term perspective. If we step back and see where something is headed, we can actually plan and adapt better than looking at it day by day or year by year. So we have to realize that for sea level, that it's going to just get higher, you know, every tens of centimeters or every foot for Americans, but it's going to become meter by meter higher, which is 3 feet by 3 feet, if you will, as a round figure. And if we're going to invest in new structures and bridges and tunnels and higher buildings and seawalls, the earlier we can plan for where things are headed, the better return on investment. So that's one. The second is, as far as the projections for sea level rise, we need to recognize there's a range of projections that for the reasons I alluded to earlier, there's no way to accurately say how far the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets will collapse, which is what will ultimately cause sea level to rise by 60-some meters over the next several centuries or millennia. We don't know. Let's begin to act knowing there's a range. So whether the range of projection by mid-century is a half meter or a meter, by the end of the century is 1 meter to 3 meters, let's start adapting now, just like we do for a range of other projections for interest rates or the price of gold or the price of real estate or the price of gasoline. Three is we need to consider geology as well as topography, I like to say. So there's the slope of the land. How quickly does it rise up will determine how far inland the rising sea level will push the shoreline. But also there's geology. Miami is porous limestone, as are most of the coral-based tropical islands like the Maldives and the Bahamas and Kiribati. And those porous limestone locations you can't protect with a seawall, because you could build a seawall right around the island, but it would, or Miami, and it would just come up inside like a sponge. The fourth is we need to recognize that ultimately, the governments can't bail us out of this. They can facilitate, they can help transition, they can do some new policies, but to think that the government's going to buy everybody out of all of the coastal land that they own is naive. It may work for year by year, maybe a decade or two, but there's no government that has the resources to compensate their people for believing the shoreline wouldn't move in the long term. And five is to begin, as you suggested earlier, that properties will be value. And you wisely pointed out that we tend to put a premium price on coastal real estate. And to realize that the coastline is going to move inland over the next century means that for those that want to look ahead and adapt intelligently, that they can choose the time to sell or to move or to raise their house, but that would be an important part of intelligent adaptation, to realize that properties will be value and we will need to either build higher, relocate, or adapt.
Some politicians, especially in Florida but elsewhere, have doubled down on denial of climate change. We had the same thing happen in Australia and for 10 years here in Canada. And the whole issue of climate change has had less coverage in the current presidential election than the sex lives of the candidates. What happens if humans are not intelligent enough to act to save themselves from mega change in the oceans?
Well, you know, that's a great question, almost a philosophical one, and it's something I do grapple with. Are we smart enough? And where I come off on the two parts of this, the two facets, again, is we're seeing more flooding, whether it be a storm surge like during a Matthew or a Sandy or a Katrina event, whether we're seeing heavier rainfall event, we're starting to see more and more flooding, and people are getting worried about that. And you can't argue with flooding. And it's the question of whether you see the pattern. Whether we can be smart enough to globally deal with burgeoning population and need for energy and rapidly enough change our energy policies, that's, I guess, a human behavior and political question, economics. There's some optimistic signs that over a course of years, British Columbia, where you happen to live, is probably the best example in the world, frankly, where the tax that was put on carbon in 2008 and escalated pretty quickly is now a model for many other places. It reduces other taxes. It wasn't an additional tax. It was a replacement tax to put the price on carbon, but reduce other forms of taxation. And now Canada's recently announced, in fact, in the last few days, that it's going to try and model that policy and expand it nationwide. So I think we'll do those things. It'll take us a few years or decades. But, you know, the good thing about sea level rise, I say, it's not a choice. It's not a choice of whether to adapt. And, of course, we can fantasize about building cities underwater and so on. But we're not going to house 7 billion or 10 billion people underwater. The truth is, as the ocean rises for the first time in all of human civilization, we will adapt. The question is whether we do it by catastrophe and crisis or by planning.
After your trip to Greenland and your handy four-part series on changes there, what will you be working on next?
Well, I'm working to start a sea level institute, the International Sea Level Institute. SeaLevelInstitute.org is a beginner website, and there's a little video there. We're looking to find the right base location and then to establish some nodes in different places in the world to help professionals like architects, engineers, bankers, town planners understand this and incorporate it into what they're doing. So that's a real passion of mine. I'm writing another book, which I hope to have out in 2017. There's a group who wants to work on a documentary about my work and even a feature film. And I'm giving more and more lectures. Last week I was in Vancouver talking to the International Association of Aquariums. A few weeks before that, I was talking to the architects of Florida. So it's bringing different interested groups into understanding, and I love doing that. And for those that are interested, it's on my website. But speaking to groups, bringing groups of professionals and different cohorts, but even environmentalists like your audience, is really an important way to get the word out.
Our guest, John Englander, advises governments and private stakeholders on the science and financial impacts of rising seas. John is a well-known oceanographer with a wealth of experience, and he's put out a comprehensive guide for the public. Still a really good book, High Tide on Main Street. You can find a lot more at John's website at johnenglander.net, and I'll put helpful links in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for being our guest on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thank you. I love the focus of your program and the fact that you're on almost 100 stations, and I appreciate the opportunity and hope that your listeners will will pursue and consider this information in the weeks and years ahead.
Good. Well, I hope to get back to you as this whole story progresses, and as we know it will. I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. On January 2nd, 2014, a giant wave of cold and snowy weather hit Canada, central and eastern U.S. states. It stayed until March. On the nightly news, we heard the cause was the polar vortex marching south. Another deadly cold wave swept through Europe in early 2012, and then there was Snowmageddon in February 2010. So what happened to global warming? How could these extreme winter events happen while the Arctic is warmer than ever? Scientists are beginning to investigate this weird development. Theodore G. Shepard is the author of a paper published September 2, 2016, in the prestigious journal Science. The title is Effects of a Warming Arctic. It asks the questions about a relationship between heating the Arctic with human greenhouse gases and colder winters further south. In the United Kingdom, Ted Shepard is the Grantham Professor of Climate Science at the University of Reading. Dr. Shepard, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
Is it just North America and Europe? Where else have colder or at least snowier winters appeared in recent years?
No, the discussion has been Europe, although it's also Asia, Central Asia, Eurasia, and the Far East. So really, it's been across the whole, the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, China got a cold blast a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, the thing is, you do get cold blasts in the winter. It is winter. And so that's the first thing to remember, is that we do have cold outbreaks, and we shouldn't be surprised by this. And I think a lot of people are just don't have long memories. So that's always something that we have to bear in mind.
Well, according to NASA, each of the last 15 months has set a record for global mean temperatures. Does that mean we've moved away from extremely cold winters?
Well, no, it doesn't. That's a statement very much about the global mean, the global average. And the global average, of course, averages over many, many things. It does mean that all things being equal, you would expect fewer cold winters. But the whole point is that all things are not equal, and climate change is uneven across the world.
What were you trying to do with your paper, Effects of a Warming Arctic?
Well, I was actually asked to do it, I guess, and science sometimes asks scientists to comment on particular topical issues. So I was really just trying to discuss the current state of the science in a balanced way. They wanted me to talk about some of the more recent evidence and just explain to people where things stood, because it's been quite a controversial area. So I was really just trying to lay out the issues without taking a position.
Well, what is the controversy among scientists?
Well, I would say the basic controversy is that, as you say, it is getting warmer, and we can even argue there's some basic physical reasons to argue that it should get warmer over land than over ocean, and also it should get warmer in the winter, warm even more in the winter than it does in the summer. So on the face of it, you wouldn't expect there to be an increase in cold winters. So if you just go with the basic, what we know for sure about climate change, then it wouldn't lead you to expect cold winters. But, of course, as I say, things could be different. You could have weirder weather. I talk about it in the paper just as a change in dynamics, a change of the jet stream and the polar vortex. Those are more exotic theories. They're ones where there's much less of a consensus, but, of course, things are possible. So really the question is, do you take a conservative view about climate change and just stick to what we know for sure, or do you look for the possibility of some more exotic behaviors that could be true but are hard to prove?
When it comes to jet stream, I interviewed Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers, who has talked about that distortion. But she told me something surprising. She said her theory really doesn't apply to winter storms. It's more summer weather that's deranged. I found that surprising. What do you know about this?
I guess I'm a little surprised, too. So I should I'm not up to date on exactly what she's talking about, because the warming is, you see it in the atmosphere in the wintertime. I mean, it's true that the ice is melting in the summer, but then what happens in the summer is that the ocean absorbs more sunlight and it warms up. Of course, there's more to it than that, but that's the sort of basic thing. And then in the winter, when you have really cold temperatures in the air, then all the heat comes out of the ocean. So when you look at the warming trends, they're larger in the winter than the summer. So on the face of it, you expect a stronger response in the wintertime. But it depends exactly on where the warming is happening and how close it is to the jet stream and so on.
Well, I better revisit that interview and make sure I got that right, because I'm not the scientist or the expert. But, you know, some experts and bloggers immediately blame climate change for almost anything strange that happens these days.
Right.
Do we have hard science to back up the idea that a warmer Arctic is definitely causing some cold winter events?
No, I don't think we have hard science. And if you ask people for a consensus, you wouldn't get it. So if you, you know, went to something, asked a body like the IPCC to say, well, what do we know about this, it's going to be very hard. It's certainly not in the category of knowing that it's going to warm up from climate change. Now, there have been a number of authoritative studies. The National Academy of Sciences tried to do a thorough study as well. But so it's much more mixed. It isn't hard science. But the issue is that we know the climate is changing. And so we can't necessarily take the past as a guide to the future, and we have to look for the possibility that there may be things going on that we don't fully understand. In other words, we have to take more of a risk-based approach. So the science is much more, you know, you might think of a public health outbreak with some very early evidence of something going on. So you wouldn't say it's hard science that there's a problem, but there is hard science in assessing what a risk might be, and that's a different kind of science, though. So that's where the controversy, I would say, lies in that sort of framing of the question.
And you've raised the issue of natural variability. Do we know whether periodic long weather cycles exist?
Oh, yes, for sure. And I mean, there's a lot of evidence in the observations. And if you run climate models for long periods of time, you can see very, very long. So, of course, in the real system, we know that the system is being forced by climate change. We don't always know what's variability and what's climate change. But in a climate model, you can force it without climate change, and you can still see all these fluctuations. So you know in that case for sure it's just a variability. So that's the thing, and you can't rule out fluctuations. You certainly can't prove that what we're seeing isn't natural variability.
In a recent paper, Dr. James Hansen and a team of scientists warned that cold meltwater from Greenland could lead to a diversion of the Gulf Stream and changes to the storm track over the UK, where you live, and Northern Europe. This could explain the very stormy winters hitting Britain, France, and Scandinavia. What do you think?
Well, there certainly is hard science behind the fact that a lot of melting of the ice sheets in the high latitudes could change the Gulf Stream and the patterns of the ocean circulation, and that would affect weather. I mean, there is something to that, and you certainly see that in historical, you know, I'm thinking of paleoclimate and so on. Now, whether that would be affecting things now, I think that's much more speculative. But certainly that is a mechanism that the people have talked about. But that would really only, you know, apply to Europe. I don't think that would affect the Central Asian part, which has got to be more from the Arctic directly, I think, if there's an effect.
So it seems to me your paper concluded that we don't have to think about either natural variability or climate change, but we have to think about how they relate. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true. I think the idea of being either or is just clearly wrong. I mean, we do have climate change going on. I mean, just from a purely philosophical point of view, you know that the system has changed, and it's just not possible philosophically that there's zero effect of the melting Arctic on the lower latitudes. So the question is really, is it significant? Is it something that we can measure? Is it something that we have to worry about? And it's a nonlinear system, so you can't separate it into climate change and variability, really. They're all coupled. And I think that's part of the issue, too, is that some people, when people do a study, and it's the same for any extreme event, some people will say, well, it was mainly natural variability, and other people will say, well, it was climate change. And, well, typically it's a bit of both.
What about the storm named Juno that buried New England and the Canadian Maritimes with great piles of snow in January 2015? Is there a climate change connection there?
Well, it's important to separate low temperature from snow, because you can, of course, the really big snowfall doesn't typically come from very low temperatures. It comes from low, cold enough to form snow, but actually warm enough that you still get a lot of moisture. If it's very, very cold, it's also very dry. And so there are actually strong arguments for why climate change could lead to more snow, because areas that were too cold to have a lot of snow become warmer to have a lot of moisture, but still cold enough to have snow. So it's certainly very possible that those big snowfalls can have a climate change component. I don't know whether it's been assessed in a quantitative way, but there's nothing counterintuitive about more snow under climate change for those areas of the Northeast.
Radio EcoShock, bright voices in dark times. Get more, ecoshock.info. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor Ted Shepherd from the University of Reading in the UK. We're talking about climate change and weird winter weather. Well, Ted, TV weather people love to show us diagrams of the polar vortex, but what is that really?
Well, the polar vortex is just a belt of air circling around the polar region. That's why it's called polar and a vortex, because it's going in a circle. It's the same phenomena that is the jet stream that we encounter when we fly west to east or east to west. And it's basically just caused by the temperature gradients between the cold temperatures at the pole and the warmer temperatures at the middle latitudes.
I heard in a podcast you say that it was easier to attribute warming events like the deadly 2003 heat wave in Europe to climate change than cooling events. Why is that?
Well, it's really just because it's getting warmer in general. And so you know that the simplest explanation or the simplest expectation is that as you warm up the atmosphere, as you warm up climate, then if nothing else changed, you would just make every warm extreme warmer and every cold extreme less cold. So that's why it's a pretty straightforward connection, and you don't need anything special or exotic. But to get cold extremes that are getting colder, you need something a little bit, I call it exotic. It doesn't have to be, I don't mean it's breaking the laws of physics, but it's appealing to some mechanism that we don't have a lot of confidence in or that other people don't fully understand. So simple arguments, I guess, are more believable arguments, and the more complicated that an argument is, the more that you might be a bit skeptical about it.
Speaking of cooling, you were co-author with John Marshall of an earlier paper looking at the asymmetry between rapid heating in the Arctic and apparent cooling of the main part of Antarctica. Since then, NASA has shown major glaciers in Antarctica are losing vast amounts of ice. Is Antarctica still cooling?
It very much depends on the region. And so, when we talk about warming of the Arctic, it's a pretty straightforward thing in the sense that every data set that you look at, the entire Arctic is warming up, maybe some regions a bit more than others. In the Antarctic, it's much more complicated, and if you look at the patterns, it very much depends on which part of the continent you're in, so it's harder to make a blanket statement. And we can go into the reasons for that, but it's a more difficult area to understand than the Arctic, which is a classical climate change response. You see Arctic warming even in past climate. It isn't just CO2. You'll see it in paleoclimates and so on. But the Antarctic is more complicated.
Well, for one thing, it's a landmass instead of an ocean, and it has these high mountain ranges and all sorts of complicating factors.
Right. So it doesn't melt. You don't have the ice albedo feedback in the same way that you have in the Arctic, where you melt the ice and you absorb more sunlight. I mean, there's just this massive block of ice. But probably one of the main differences is the fact that it's encircled by this ocean, very strong ocean currents, whereas the Arctic Ocean is comparatively feeble. I mean, it's rather shallow, doesn't have very strong currents, but the Southern Ocean is extremely deep, and there's this tremendous current, and that's a major choke point in the whole ocean circulation called the thermohaline circulation. And so that's a really crucial part of the climate system, which involves, say, deep waters coming out from below.
That same paper with Marshall helped me with a problem, Ted, that I've never completely understood. It's the relationship between the ozone hole and climate change, and many people in the public have those two confused. Ted Shepherd, is there a relationship, and if so, what is it?
There is a couple of aspects, I guess. The one aspect is that the chlorofluorocarbons that cause the ozone hole are also greenhouse gases. So there was a warming globally from the CFCs, which is part of the climate problem. It's not a negligible part. It's, through the last few decades of the 20th century, it was something like 30% of the effect of CO2. But then there's this regional impact. So when people talk about the ozone hole, they're actually talking very specifically about a climate effect over the high latitudes in the southern hemisphere. And there it's a really big effect. And there it's something which is not completely understood, but I think is strongly believed because there's multiple lines of evidence and models and observations, and that's that the ozone hole, it leads to a cooling of the stratosphere, of course, because you have less ozone and therefore absorbing less sunlight. And then because of the temperature gradient, because the cooling is localized over the polar region, that changes the winds. And then that change in the winds affects the surface climate. And so there's been quite a strong effect from the ozone hole, especially in the summertime, in the summer season of the summer hemisphere. You could say there's climate change caused by the ozone hole, which is different from the climate change caused by CO2. So they have some relationships, but they have some differences as well.
But that paper says that by mid-century, the ozone hole effects may instead be adding to greenhouse gas warming around Antarctica. Could you tell us about that?
so there's a kind of a simple, that's the ocean feedback aspect, I guess. The atmospheric, for example, it's been pretty well documented that the effect of the ozone hole on the winds and basically on the polar vortex in the southern hemisphere has been a strengthening, which is acting in the same sense as climate change. And actually, as the ozone hole goes away, as the CFCs come down over the next 50 years or so, that will reverse. But in terms of sea ice, I think there's a lot of debate about what's happening in Antarctic sea ice. And there, I think the story is still a very open story. And the Marshall et al. Paper talks about the role of the ocean in that and the fact you've got these different response time scales. And so even the ozone hole, you can't say that the ozone hole causes, say, an increase in sea ice or a decrease in sea ice, because there's one response on a relatively short time scale, a few years or 10 years or so, and then there's another response on a longer time scale. So it starts to get quite complicated, and you have to look at the whole history of the forcing. It's not just, you know, a simple cause and effect.
All right. Now, in June 2015, you co-authored a paper with Kevin Trenberth on extreme weather events and whether or not we can attribute them to climate change. I gather you had the same problem of weighing a changed atmosphere versus possible long-term variability.
Yes, that's exactly the issue. And again, it comes down to this issue of, is there hard scientific evidence? Or, you know, just because you can't prove that something is happening doesn't mean that it isn't happening. And if you're taking a precautionary approach, you have to ask yourself a different question. Can we prove that there isn't an effect of climate change? And that's a much harder thing to do. So it was a controversial topic, similarly controversial, I guess, in the sense of extreme events. And in the Trenberth paper specifically, things like storms and extreme precipitation, anything where there's a strong weather element to it. And for a lot of these events, it's very hard to prove that they're not just variability, because there's always storms, there's always variability. So the argument there was that we can't just be quite so conservative. We have to ask, given that the event happened, how much worse was it? And that's a different kind of statement. So we're trying to argue there for a more precautionary approach to looking at extreme events.
Well, sure. In a perfect world, we could wait another 50 years to know what is natural variability and what is not. But you and I know the climate threat is so urgent, we can't wait that long. What is to be done?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. If you wait, when we talk about heat waves and we talk about the thing where the science is absolutely firm, then there's not really a problem. We know that ice is melting in the Arctic, and that's because of climate change, and we know that the global mean temperature is warming up, and that's because of climate change. And you could say we've already waited too long. I mean, we've definitely dug ourselves into a hole with climate change, but the observations are clear on that respect. But if we're talking about weather events and a lot of these dynamically related extremes, if we wait until the observations are clear, it'll be much, much too late. So we need to start thinking about acting before we have the full evidence, and that's a complicated thing, because it means looking at the climate models, but the climate models give various stories. Sometimes they don't always agree. There's reasons that we can't necessarily trust them, so we have to use our knowledge of basic physics and, you know, mechanisms, and it's a much more complicated. It's a very interesting scientific story to say, how do we bring together all the evidence, and how do we distinguish between plausible threats and implausible threats?
Well, we don't like complex systems or complex answers. Do you worry scientific caution may confuse the public, maybe actually delaying climate action?
Well, that's, of course, the worry, is that if we use the current, kind of what I would say, the conventional scientific language, then we just bury everything in caveats and no one does anything. But, you know, I had a bit of a debate with a climate skeptic once a number of years ago. This was after Katrina had hit New Orleans. And he was saying, oh, you can't prove this is climate change or whatever. And I just said, well, if you were the head of civil engineering in New Orleans and you had to rebuild the levees, and a climate scientist said, well, we expect sea level is going to go up because of climate change. We don't know exactly how much, but we're pretty sure it's going to go up. And we also think that hurricanes might be more intense. There's a bit of it's a bit of a controversial topic, but there are some pretty sound physical arguments for why the most extreme hurricanes might be more extreme. So would you build the levees higher? And he said, of course I would. So it does seem to me, if you put people in a position where they have a decision to make, a concrete decision, and you say, let's weigh up the evidence, shall we make an investment to protect ourselves, then people will make a certain choice. So I think the key is not to get lost in the abstract question, but to think of very specific questions and very specific actions.
Well, this past summer was hot again in Alaska, northern Canada, and Siberia. Do you have any ideas or predictions? I hate to use the word predictions to a scientist, about what kind of winter we'll get this year in the Northern Hemisphere?
Oh, I wouldn't want to make a prediction because winters can be highly variable, and there is a business of trying to predict what will happen in a particular winter. It's called seasonal prediction, and people certainly do work at that a lot. I don't actually know what the predictions are for this winter, so I wouldn't hazard a guess. But in any case, that the skill level is not very high in the sense that there's just a lot of variability, a lot of chaos in the system. So I wouldn't want to hazard a guess. So.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about your work or your research group and where it's going?
Well, I guess where I'm struggling or challenged by, I guess you could say, is trying to find the right language to talk about these things. And I hope that's maybe come through in the interview, is that the challenges that we're facing in climate science is how to talk about risks without sounding completely uncertain, but also without losing sight of the things that we do know for sure. So it's kind of a tricky line to walk, I think, because we do know that there's absolutely clear risks from rising sea level and rising temperature and so on. Then we have the risks that are a little more tricky. For example, the California drought has been a major controversy and, issue, I should say, and then controversy among climate scientists, and how much of that might be due to climate change and how worse might things get in the future. Those are very difficult questions where you can't really prove things at the same level that you would like to. We can talk about things like rising sea level. So how do we talk about that in a scientifically a defensible way? So that's where I'm trying to think of the right ways to frame things and actually considering new approaches like storyline approaches is something that I'm thinking about. So rather than trying to be probabilistic, you say what's plausible, which is a different question, and working with psychologists about how you frame questions and things like that. So I think this is where a lot of the new areas are going to be, is actually how we talk about the science, because it's not the usual way that we would do things. If you're running an experiment at CERN about particle physics and you don't have enough data, you just wait till you have data. You wouldn't try to publish. But we're dealing with an urgent threat here, so you have to make decisions based on what you know. It's a different kind of scientific problem.
From the University of Reading, UK, we've been speaking with Professor Ted Shepherd. He's the Grantham Professor of Climate Science. He's a much-published scientist and an expert in atmospheric circulation, among other things. And you can find links to Ted's university website and the papers we've discussed in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Ted, thank you so much for sharing your time and work with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
I made a mistake in that interview with Ted Shepherd. The melting of the Arctic sea ice in the summer can affect the type of winters further south in North America, Europe, Russia, and even China and Japan. It's an important point, and I'll clear it up with some clips from my past interviews with Jennifer Francis. Plus, I'll put more links and explanation in my show blog at ecoshock.info. But first, I'd like to tell you the good news, bad news, about the new global agreement to reduce warming impacts of the gases used in refrigeration and air conditioning. On October 15th, 200 countries signed a deal to limit and then phase out the use of the chemicals HFCs used in refrigeration. These hydrofluorocarbons are in your fridge and car air conditioner right now. They're in the big freezers, in grocery stores, and giant commercial air conditioners in buildings across the world. HFCs are hundreds of times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Some say they are thousands of times more powerful. The aim of this treaty, which is an amendment to the 1987 Montreal Protocol, is to avoid half a degree centigrade of global warming that would have hit the planet from the overuse of these chemicals alone. Considering the current alleged safe limit is only 1.5 degrees C of warming over pre-industrial times, and we're already pretty well at 1 degree, it sounds like refrigerants could push us into dangerous climate change even if we stopped the coal plants and car exhausts today. It's a big deal, half a degree of warming. It's also a bittersweet moment for me and for all environmentalists who remember 1987. At that time, 25 years ago, The Greens and a few scientists warned loudly that switching from CFCs, which did destroy the ozone layer, as well as being greenhouse gases, to HFCs was a huge mistake. We knew even then that HFCs were a potent greenhouse gas that would add up to damage to the world's atmosphere. I was there in the fight. We warned them. Frankly, the biggest CFC producers, including the DuPont Corporation, dragged their feet and fought off CFC regulations until they had a new product to offer, HFCs. And that's what the chemical industry pushed. HFCs were more expensive and gave the chemical companies another few decades of big profits. There were other safe alternatives already known. These included things like propane, butane, and ammonia. More research and development might have done even better. Nobody listened. The world cheered as our civilization turned from one damaging chemical to another. People around the world are installing more and more air conditioning. It's becoming an air-conditioned world, and no wonder, it's getting hotter and hotter. As HFC sales soar, the damage and further heating became too obvious to ignore. So now, finally, and too late, the governments of the world are prepared for a slow, painfully slow phase-out of yet another greenhouse gas. The deal allows China to keep making and installing HFCs until 2024 and India until 2028. That's where most of the new air conditioning and fridges will be sold. When those units break down, need to be replaced, or just leak, the HFCs will continue to pour into the atmosphere for more decades, into the last half of this century. You will be told the refrigerants will be collected and burned. But let's get real. This isn't happening now in most places and won't in the future. We're committing to releasing very powerful greenhouse gases as we try to cool ourselves on this hotter planet. Maybe that agreement was the best anyone could get. It's something. But it won't save us from the ravages of climate change. We need a drastic change to refrigeration and air conditioning, with the whole conversion by 2020 at the latest. Like CFCs, the sale of HFCs need to be criminalized very soon to save what's left of our atmosphere. It's time for new pressure and campaigns to get that done.
This is for all the protesters who are standing up along the line, standing up for what you believe, and it doesn't matter what the price. This is for all the peace lovers who are peacing out on this great land, peacefully being passive while the oppressors are getting out of hand. And I just want to thank you for your passion and conviction. I just want to thank you for your never gonna give it up attitude. I just want to thank you for your passion and conviction.
Let's get back to the jet stream and Arctic ice science. Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University pioneered this science. Here's what she told us on Radio EcoShock in 2012.
I should mention that in the summertime, the extreme weather that we get in the summer is actually probably not directly linked to the sea ice. I think it's actually directly linked more to the rapid decrease in the amount of snow cover on high-latitude land. Over the last couple of decades, while the sea ice has been melting, we've also been observing that the snow has been melting ever earlier from high-latitude land areas. And this has a very similar effect as the sea ice does, but in a different season, of course. And what happens is when you remove the snow earlier, you expose the soil to the strong spring sunshine earlier, which allows that soil to warm up earlier. And so you end up with the same situation that I described for the sea ice, where you're enhancing the temperatures at high latitudes in the Arctic more than lower latitudes. So the same thing's happening. You're reducing this temperature difference, which also weakens the jet stream and I think is playing a role in the drought that we had this year in the U.S., heat waves, and other summer types of extreme weather.
And now here is the update in our interview in March 2015. Another challenge for research has been the different patterns in different seasons. The last time I talked with you a couple of years ago, you seemed fairly sure about what was happening in the fall and winter, but less sure about the spring and summer. Is this Arctic change affecting all four seasons now?
Well, we think it is. And since we talked a couple of years ago, there's been a lot of research been done by a bunch of different groups around the world looking at this linkage between Arctic change and weather patterns in mid-latitudes. And what we've learned is that the mechanisms that are creating the linkages vary with season and with location. So there isn't sort of one story we can tell that explains this linkage. A group in Germany, for example, has been looking at connections between ice loss in the Arctic and summer extreme weather patterns over Europe and Asia, and finding that the loss of sea ice in the summertime is contributing to these sorts of extreme events because that warming in the Arctic is causing the jet stream to split sometimes in the summer. It's more likely to do that when there's less sea ice. And when the jet stream splits, it tends to trap these waves in the jet stream and they tend to stay in one place. And that leads to some of the extreme events that are related to very persistent weather patterns like heat waves and drought and flooding. So that's, you know, one of these mechanisms that have been studied that is just a summer mechanism. There are others that people have been identifying that occur only in the wintertime. One of these that appears to be very robust is a link to ice loss over Western Russia in the Arctic area just north of Western Russia, and that seems to be causing the tendency for very cold winters over Central Asia. So a lot of people are looking at these various aspects of the linkage, and we're learning a lot.
I hope that makes it clear to everyone. The rapid heating of the Arctic will create unstable weather in the Northern Hemisphere. In the winter, there may be nastier snowstorms, even punishing cold snaps, in large regions. In the summer, there can be longer and hotter heat waves, droughts, and of course extreme rainfall that just stalls over a large area due to the lazier jet stream. Changes to the Arctic from our release of greenhouse gases are so profound, they are one of the biggest signs and proofs we have entered the new geologic age, the Anthropocene. You can review this program, and I would, and you can pass it on, please do, by downloading it for free from the show website at ecoshock.org. Let's get everyone informed on the climate reality behind the weird weather porn we see on TV. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. Mother Earth is under the weather right now. Mother Earth is under the weather right now. We are the caretakers, guardians of the earth, caretakers. Time to do a little more caring. I know that we can change the world.
This is for all the protesters who are standing up along the line. Standing up for what you believe, and it doesn't matter what the price. This is for all the peace lovers who are peacing out on this great land.
But now we're going to turn to a doctor of law, David Jacobs. Are you there, David?
Not quite a doctor of law, although, such appointments.
How about veteran lawyer, David?
Yeah, veteran. I'm feeling like a veteran. That's true. I'm not a veteran lawyer, but a veteran anyway.
Yes, a surviving lawyer who has – you've practiced law at been in the trenches where really we, of course, find out whether all these wonderful institutions – function properly or not. You practiced, you defended people at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. You also were involved with the Yugoslav matter. And we have this headline today, and people are talking about it, and that is that South Africa is announcing that it's going to withdraw from the new permanent International Criminal Court. Why are they doing that?
Well, they've sent a letter, which is, they call an instrument of withdrawal, to the Secretary General of the United Nations. And they really give a number of reasons, but I think it's probably better for me to read from their instrument of withdrawal. And the instrument of withdrawal is accompanied by a declaratory statement, which explains it a bit further. But I won't read the whole thing, and please stop me if I'm going on.
Right.
But they say that this, I'm going to read from it. Whereas the Republic of South Africa has found that its obligations with respect to the peaceful resolution of conflicts at times are incompatible with the interpretation given by the International Criminal Court of obligations contained in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, as explained in their attachment, therefore the Republic of South Africa hereby withdraws from the same. Such withdrawal to take effect 1 year, that's under the Rome Statute. And their explanation is that whereas they were a founding member of the International Criminal Court, and one of the first signatories to the Rome Statute, which founded the court, the Rome Statute of the International Court, they're also, they say in their declaration, a proud member of the African Union, which has a strong focus on protecting promoting human security, peace, and stability. What concerned them is that they were involved in a peace process involving warring parties in Sudan. And when President Omar al-Bashir came to South Africa, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court said, you must arrest him. And they said, well, how can we arrest him and engage him in conflict resolution discussions? We can't do both.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue was sent to their Supreme Court, which ruled that the Rome Statute, the ICC, International Criminal Court, governed over the domestic law of South Africa, which recognized sovereign immunity, that is, the immunity of all heads of government from prosecution, something, by the way, Canada recognizes and other states recognize and so on. So the South African government said, well, if that's correct, we'll appeal the decision of the Supreme Court of South Africa. But in any event, we're pulling out of the Rome Statute, so there's no conflict, and we can apply our own law. They complained further that under the Rome Statute, there's a process for consultation between states when there are problems. And they tried to invoke that consultation process, but they were met with a legal response. And they said that's not what they expected. They wanted to consult and talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is that, starting with the ad hoc tribunals, which had specific goals, the ad hoc tribunal for Rwanda had a specific goal involving Rwanda, and the prosecutor acted within that, and same with Yugoslavia, there aren't any specific goals for the International Criminal Court. And the prosecutor has this extraordinary, amazingly broad discretion to investigate any country she feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the bases for starting those investigations? So you have the investigations of Burundi and Sudan, which I believe is not even a signatory.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens at the end of the day? And Burundi is pulling out as well because they claim that the International Criminal Court is not a fair and balanced court. Yeah,
well, by the way, I guess they don't discuss this because it's probably another matter from the point of view of the author of the document you read to us. But in fact, the only people prosecuted by this Hague court are Africans.
I believe they do talk about it. I'm sort of scanning the
because
document.
If they
quickly.
Do, no African country should be a member. I mean, it's an outrage. Of course, we're to understand that the United States is not a signatory, and nobody ever talks about whether they could be charged.
Well, maybe I can read a bit more if you,
please,
if you and your readers can tolerate it. This is from the declaration, which is attached to the memorandum, which they said. South Africa doesn't view the ICC in isolation, but as an important element in a new system of international law and governance. Questions on the credibility of the International Criminal Court will persist so long as three of the five permanent members of the Security Council are not state parties to the statute. The Security Council has not played its part in terms of Article 16 of the Rome Statute, where the involvement of the ICC will pose a threat to peace and security on the African continent.
Mm-hmm.
There is also perceptions of inequality and unfairness in the practice of the ICC that don't only emanate from the court's relationship with the Security Council, but also by the perceived focus of the ICC on African states, notwithstanding clear evidence of violations by others. Mm-hmm. South Africa, from its own experience, has always expressed the view that to keep peace, one must first make peace.
Well, it's couldn't be more apropos. But and David, I want to point out, and maybe you've thought about this as well, we recently had a vote in Colombia to end a war between a guerrilla movement, a progressive movement, and the central government. And it involved a referendum, and the referendum said no to the peace agreement. And they said a major factor in bringing about the defeat of the referendum was that human rights organizations insisted that they should be prepared to prosecute people who had been guilty of war crimes during the conflict. So rather than ending a conflict, that position makes it go on, because if you're not going to be able to strike a settlement between warring parties, but instead allow somebody from Harvard to tell you who had committed a crime or who hadn't, based on a report to an exclusive organization, then you're not going to have any peace. You just have an instrument that permits war.
Yeah, and this is, I think, at the heart of the problem with international criminal law and how international criminal law actually deviates from the trajectory of international humanitarian law, which had more of a focus on peace. And again, the South Africans say it quite starkly, although you won't find this in the many criticisms of the South African government, South African government's action on the ICC, where they say the involvement of the ICC the involvement of the ICC will pose a threat to peace and security on the African continent. And look, I mean, the extraordinary, unbelievable discretion that the prosecution has at the International Criminal Court. You can see how it acted in a way that did not promote peace. For example, when the U.S. and its coalition allies decided to take a step further than the U.N. Security Council's no-fly zone in Libya, and they went to all-out bombing of Libya in an effort to oust Gaddafi. At the very beginning of that bombing, the prosecutor for the International Criminal Court unveiled an indictment of Muammar Gaddafi and his sons for war crimes. And this has its echo in what happened with the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, where the chief prosecutor stood up on television in a press conference with Robin Cook, one of the defense minister for Great Britain, one of the NATO countries involved in the bombing of Yugoslavia, to unveil what was a secret indictment of President Milosevic.
Yes.
That was at a time when enthusiasm for the bombing of Yugoslavia was flagging, particularly in Europe, and at a time when there were various dignitaries were trying to see if they can do some conflict resolution between Milosevic and his NATO adversaries. But at that time, my recollection is that their chief prosecutor said, justice must come before peace.
Yes.
So that tells you that the prosecutor of the ICC in the Libyan situation, the Burundian situation, the Sudanese situation,
yes,
all of which exemplifies what the South African government has said soberly and people should really think about, are the obstacle to peace.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And you know, whatever they may like to quibble, South Africa has obviously thrown down the gauntlet, and South Africa is a major state. My understanding is that they expect Kenya to follow and probably Uganda. And I notice there's a kind of colonial way of talking about this, which is, they're bad people. And so we should just jimmy the law, as it were, to get them anyway. When in fact, their position is consistent with previous international law prior to this great human rights crusade has been led with a red and white and blue flag.
Yes, I mean, my thinking is that prior to this flowering of international criminal law, international humanitarian law had a completely reverse idea of things. The idea under international humanitarian law is that you create the conditions for peace first, you gain peace first. After that, you try and sort out the criminality, if any.
Yes.
This is entirely the other way around.
Yeah. Well, my memory was that Louise Arbour said you cannot talk to Mr. Milosevic because he's a criminal.
You can't negotiate with – there's no negotiation with war criminals, I think, is the phrase, which – I mean, yeah. If you think about it
– And the further detail is that, of course, he was never convicted.
He was never
After
convicted.
After years of trial, nobody showed that he committed these crimes.
And as a kind of what lawyers call obiter dicta, which means things said and not necessarily rulings and so on, in the Karadzic case, in order to tell the world what a terrible person Karadzic is, they said, well, we find that Milosevic didn't do the things he's accused of,
yes,
or at least some of the major things he's accused of. So you can't shelter behind Milosevic. It's quite frightening. And if you really adhere to the idea that you can't negotiate with war criminals, particularly at a time when nobody has made any legal determination that somebody has committed any sort of crime, let alone a war crime.
Yeah, you can't negotiate with someone who's presumed guilty.
That's right. That's right. That this is the extraordinary power of the prosecution. And again, the power of the prosecution at the ICTR, ICTY was fairly extraordinary. But this this is an expansion beyond all bounds. We don't need to know why the prosecutor picked Burundi or Sudan over, let's say, others who are being accused of violating the laws of war.
I could name some.
You could name some, maybe some rather big actors.
Yes, you could probably, but we want to stay on the air. So, well, David, we do appreciate it because you set us up nicely. We're going to be talking to a gentleman about Burundi, so we're going to get that story as well. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Jacobs, thank you. And this is CIUT, 89.5 FM. You can check us at Facebook / The Taylor Report. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And we encourage you to do so, as the guy says on another show.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with People for the American Way, who discusses how the outcome of this year's presidential election will influence future decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court. Bridget Flaherty, an organizer with a grassroots group GOP Hands Off Me, who explains why women have risen up to demand the Republican Party withdraw its endorsement of presidential candidate Donald Trump. And Roger Salazar of California's Yes on 61 campaign, who talks about the fight being waged to win a ballot measure this November that would require state agencies to pay the same low prices for prescription drugs as paid by the Veterans Administration. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The African nation of Kenya is moving quickly to empty out the massive Dadaab refugee camp, home to over 300,000 refugees from Somalia by the end of November. According to Foreign Policy magazine, there are charges that Kenyan troops are carrying out forced evictions. Over the last 2 years, more than 28,000 refugees have returned to Somalia under United Nations direction. The returnees must then compete with 1 million other displaced persons in Somalia, still in the midst of a civil war, which has created harsh living conditions. The refugees are returned to places like Kismayo, where the city's mayor, Ibrahim Mohamed Yusuf, explained, "People are being dumped here with no international support. There are no shelters, no food, no health care, and no schools. We are a small country reeling from civil war. How can we be expected to care for more people?" Advocates for refugees and aid workers want to halt the massive repatriation, which is bankrolled by the U.S. government. Doctors Without Borders has proposed setting up a series of smaller camps in Kenya to replace the Dadaab camp, which first opened in the early 1990s. Doctors Without Borders Kenya director Lisbeth Albrecht lamented, "Thousands are essentially being pushed back into conflict and acute crisis, the very conditions they fled." The epicenter in America's debate over money in politics is now being fought in South Dakota, a rural state with less than 1 million people. Its voters will decide the fate of Measure 22, a ballot initiative that would establish a system of public financing for candidates, create a state ethics commission, and ban legislators from accepting gifts from lobbyists. The fight over Measure 22 also pits two sets of out-of-state megadonors against each other in a state that has not seen many big corruption scandals. Measure 22 is backed by the Massachusetts-based reform group Represent Us, which is bankrolled by several Silicon Valley tech titans. Opposition to Measure 22 is organized by the Tea Party-affiliated Americans for Prosperity, funded by the billionaire Koch brothers, and supported by other right-wing activist groups. South Dakota, with its populist heritage, has a long history of direct democracy dating back to 1898 and has been a testing ground for debating national issues. On this fall's ballot, South Dakota citizens will vote on 10 questions, half of them financed by wealthy out-of-state donors. The New Hampshire Firearms Safety Coalition, founded by gun store owner Ralph D'Amico, advocates for the safe storage of guns and for providing aid to gun owners in emotional distress in an effort to prevent suicides. Nationally, over 400 people a week commit suicide using a gun. In 2010, the New Hampshire Coalition began distributing pamphlets and posters on suicide prevention to gun stores. The group took a harm reduction approach, similar to campaigns on drug addiction. Harvard University public health researcher Catherine Barber, who advises gun safety groups, told the Christian Science Monitor, "It makes sense to work within the culture of gun-owning groups." D'Amico got involved in gun safety work after he was told by Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital that three people had committed suicide within a week of legally purchasing a gun at his store. Even as the homicide rate has fallen since 2000, the suicide rate has increased dramatically across America. Nationally, men are now four times as likely to use a gun to commit suicide as women. In 2014, the U.S. government documented over 21,000 suicides using a gun. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After saturation media coverage of Donald Trump's insults and personal attacks, as well as daily focus on Hillary Clinton's email server and leaked campaign emails, there are a host of critical issues that haven't received the attention they deserve in the 2016 election campaign. One of those issues is how the outcome of this November's presidential election will influence future decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court. After the death of the Supreme Court's staunchest conservative and longest-serving justice, Antonin Scalia, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asserted that the nomination of a replacement should wait until after the November 2016 election. However, in March, President Obama, following the U.S. Constitution, nominated Merrick Garland, Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, to fill the vacancy. As promised, the GOP-controlled Senate has blocked a vote on Garland's nomination, resulting in several 4-4 ties between the conservative and liberal wings of the court on key cases. With the likelihood that several elderly justices may retire in the near future, the next president could appoint as many as 4 new members of the court. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, executive vice president with the group People for the American Way, who discusses what Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have said about what would guide their selection of future nominees to the court and the critical issues at stake.
Just about every issue the American public cares about deeply is affected by the Supreme Court. So if you care about being able to have reasonable regulations of rules around campaign finance, if you care about the environment, if you care about voting rights, if you care about women's rights, if you care about choice, if you care about LGBT equality, if you care about workers' rights to organize, if you care about immigrants' rights, every single one of those is affected by who sits on the court and the balance on the Supreme Court. What we have now is a court that essentially is tied 4-4 and is paralyzed in many cases from making decisions. For example, in the recent case involving the president's executive actions on immigration. So there's a huge, huge amount at stake in this election around who sits on the court, not just in terms of whether we continue to have the vacancy that Merrick Garland's been nominated to remain empty, which remains to be seen. But because there are at least 3 more justices who, during the course of this next presidency, will be more than 80 years old, and the average retirement age for justices is less than that. So the future of the court for generation is at stake in this election, which is why it's so critical and we've been working so hard.
Marge, can you describe for our listeners the relative positions of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as relates to the Supreme Court and what their plan would be?
Secretary Clinton has articulated a standard for the kinds of justices that she would look for, and she said that she wants justices to respect the Constitution that's there for all Americans, not just the powerful and the privileged. And she's been clear about issues such as choice and campaign finance rules, reasonable campaign finance rules, and LGBT equality, and any number of workers' rights, any number of issues. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has basically said he's going to outsource the selection of his nominees to a very, very conservative Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, and he's given us a list of justices that he would nominate to the bench if he were elected. That is truly frightening. One of the justices on his list believes that Social Security, Medicare, minimum wage, child labor laws, disaster relief, food safety laws, and the Violence Against Women Act are all unconstitutional. And another called the Roe v. Wade decision the worst abomination of constitutional law in our history. So the choices could not be more stark. between these two candidates. And what we've been trying to emphasize as we talk to voters is, you know, there's a binary choice here. It's going to be either Secretary Clinton or Donald Trump who are going to be president, and they will have the ability to choose to replace three, potentially four justices on the Supreme Court. And so it matters. It absolutely matters in a presidential election who you vote for. And frankly, it also matters in terms of the Senate, because we've seen what a GOP-controlled Senate will do in terms of ignoring its constitutional responsibility to give the nominee fair consideration. So if the Senate remains in Republican hands and Secretary Clinton is elected president, she's still going to have trouble getting her nominees through. So we absolutely, in our view, have to have a Democratic-controlled Senate in order to make sure that the nominees that Secretary Clinton puts forward, if she's elected president, will actually be given fair consideration.
There are many disgruntled progressive activists who basically want to opt out of this election,
mm-hmm.
not happy with the choices of either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And you often hear them say, you know, it doesn't really matter. If I sit out the election or I vote for a third party candidate, what's the difference? It's all going to be horrible anyway.
Yeah.
You know, kind of just very cynical. And you know, who can blame people for having that attitude? But when you get to the real world, and we've been talking about it tonight, there are some fundamental choices that will be made by the next president as regards to the Supreme Court that will affect people in this country for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ahead. What's your best argument that you make for people not to sit out this election, even if they are convinced that they are voting for the lesser of two evils?
Yeah, I mean, this is a unique moment in history where we have an opportunity to rebalance the court and have it and rebalance it in favor of the American people as opposed to sort of wealthy, powerful special interests. And kind of shame on us if we don't take advantage of that moment. And it is a choice that voters will make that affect not just the next 4 years, but generations, the next 40 years or more. And so there's a stark choice to be made here. And if there were a single reason for someone who, and I totally understand people who are, you know, disenchanted with the choices, but if there is a reason to go out and vote, there is a huge choice here, and it's going to be either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton who's going to be selecting up to three or four justices on the Supreme Court who serve for life and therefore will be there for generations. And it is a critical, critical opportunity, and kind of shame on us if we don't take advantage of that.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with the group People for the American Way. Find more analysis and commentary on the 2016 election and future of the Supreme Court by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The political environment in the U.S. presidential election campaign began shifting after the release of a video recording in which Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump bragged about sexually assaulting women. He said, "When you're a celebrity, they let you do it." The video clip, where Trump boasted about kissing, groping, and attempting to have sex with women, was recorded in a 2005 conversation with Access Hollywood TV show host Billy Bush, which was captured on a live microphone. Since the release of the tape, more than 10 women have publicly accused Trump of engaging in harassment and sexual assault over the last decade or more. Some Republican elected officials who had endorsed Trump disavowed him, while many others have maintained their support for his candidacy. Accusations that he had harassed mostly white women brought the issue closer to home for many white politicians, who could imagine their wives or daughters being similarly assaulted. First Lady Michelle Obama's heartfelt, unscripted 9-minute speech about Trump's behavior went viral, in which she said the men in her life, and the men in millions of other women's lives, don't engage in the kind of so-called locker room banter that Trump alleged this was. Another response to the scandal was a grassroots uprising of women who organized protests on October 18th in 15 cities under the slogan GOP Hands Off Me. They excoriated Trump and demanded that the Republican Party withdraw their endorsement of the real estate billionaire. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with one of the action's organizers, Bridget Flaherty, who explained how the simultaneous demonstrations were organized and their plan of action after the November 8th election.
This really is a grassroots organic response, you know, definitely prompted by the Trump case being released. But also, I think women who have just been outraged since the first time Trump made an outrageously racist and sexist comment, which was all Mexicans are racist, right? For some time now, for his entire run for presidency, there has been anger brewing and a fight back brewing of women across all races. And I think the Trump tapes just became that spark that ignited women taking to the streets and really saying that we are not going to stand for a president, but also a system that is building its power and policy off of racism and sexism. You know, it was definitely this moment when a couple of friends got on the phone and said, we have to respond and we have to get out there and really show that there is a multiracial feminist movement that is emerging and growing and really taking its power from the other organizing that has happened before, particularly with women of color in racial justice spaces, Black Lives Matter, Mi Gente.
But you're not just focusing on Trump, right?
GOP Hands Off Me is really an expression of rage against the entire Republican Party. All of their electeds who basically made Trump, right? Trump is created by the Republican Party. It's been created by, like I was saying, their policies and practices over so many years of misogyny and racism and anti-immigrant hatred. And that's why we're really directing it at Trump, but also directing it at the Republican Party because of their role and the responsibility they have in this moment, creating this man who literally embodies everything terrible about this system.
Bridget Flaherty, tell us what happened across the country when women came out for these actions.
On October 18th, thousands of women across the country did GOP Hands Off Me actions in 15 cities. You saw them in smaller places like Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and then you had New York City, Miami, Philly, D.C., Oakland, Denver. Thousands of women taking to the streets, multiracial feminist wave of action demanding the GOP take their hands off them and create a world that values women, women of color, immigrants, trans and queer folks.
When you focus on criticizing the Republican Party, does your movement take any position on the election or on the Democratic Party?
You know, I like to say that rape culture is a bipartisan problem. This is not something that is unique to the Republican Party, and we know that Democrats have also been complicit in creating a culture that doesn't respect women and have created policies that particularly have hurt women of color and immigrants. But for right now, we are very focused on ending the reign, the racist and sexist reign of the Republican Party and making sure Trump doesn't get in office. But you can believe that when anybody gets into office, whether at the state level, the federal level, or president after November 8th, that there is a movement of women that will hold them accountable to creating a world that values women of color, that values immigrants, that values queer and trans folks. And that's what we're going to be doing post-November 8th.
You said it was very grassroots and individuals got together. Is there any organization that contributed to making this happen?
I would say that, I mean, individuals, the women who got on the phone that Friday night, we come out of a tradition of organizing. We all have been organizing for many years. We created a container for women to come in and heal in a space and be seen by each other, but also express their rage. And that is truly, it is a grassroots movement.
That was Bridget Flaherty, an organizer with a grassroots group, GOP Hands Off Me. For more information on the group and their protest actions, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. California, which has a long tradition of empowering voters to decide critical public policy issues, will have 17 statewide referendum questions on the ballot this November. Among those ballot measures are proposals to repeal the state's death penalty, legalize marijuana for recreational use, and requiring actors use condoms during the filming of pornographic films. However, Proposition 61, one of the referendum questions before voters this November, has attracted the most money contributed by donors to defeat the measure. Prop 61 would regulate drug prices by requiring state agencies to pay the same prices for prescription drugs that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs pays. The VA negotiates drug prices with pharmaceutical companies, paying on average 25% less for drugs than other government agencies. Supporters of the measure say that if approved, the new regulation could save California taxpayers an estimated $5.7 billion over the next 10 years. Opponents warn that if Proposition 61 is implemented, it would only assist the state's poor, increase prices for veterans, and reduce access to some medicines. Thus far, pharmaceutical companies have contributed most of the $108 million to defeat Proposition 61. The AIDS Healthcare Foundation, one of the initiators of the ballot question, has spent about $14 million to support it. Your reporter spoke with Roger Salazar, a spokesperson for the Yes on 61 campaign, who explains the purpose and benefit of Proposition 61 for California citizens, its power as an example for other states around the country, and threat to drug company monopoly pricing.
Basically, what the California Drug Price Relief Act, or Proposition 61, would do is it would require the state of California to negotiate with drug companies for drug prices that are no more than is paid for the same drugs by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The Department of Veterans Affairs pays the lowest price of any federal agency, and so what this measure would do would empower the state as the healthcare buyer for millions of Californians to negotiate that same or even better deal for taxpayers. And right now, the state of California spends about $4 billion a year in prescription drugs that it is responsible for purchasing. The Department of Veterans Affairs gets, anywhere from a 24%, up to 40% in some cases, but at least an average of 24% less for medication than other government agencies do. So we kind of extrapolated from that if the state of California were to get the same deal that the Department of Veterans Affairs gets, it would save the state about $1 billion a year. Healthcare costs, are sharply increasing. Drug prices are now the fastest growing cost component of healthcare costs. The drug prices continue to skyrocket, and what we've seen lately is drug companies are raising their prices at will, even on decades old drugs, whose creation has been paid for many times over. So, they continue to prioritize profits over saving lives. And from our perspective, we felt there was a strong need to take a stand against the price gouging that's been going on and let the pharmaceutical industry know the Californians aren't going to stand for it anymore.
Roger, tell our listeners who's lined up for and against Proposition 61 in California, including prominent politicians and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders and his new organization, Our Revolution, has come out in support of Proposition 61. We have the California Nurses Association and National Nurses United. We have AARP, the largest, obviously, group of senior consumer advocates that are supporting us, as well as Social Security Works, California State Retirees, and the California Alliance for Retired Americans. We have the Urban League. We have Dolores Huerta, who is one of the founders of the United Farm Workers Movement here in California, as well as most of the local Democratic organizations, Democratic Party organizations in California. A lot of the folks that we have seen line up on the no side, who have lined up in opposition to this measure, have some sort of financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. So, whether it's the California Medical Association or, any number of these other groups who have lined up with the pharmaceutical industry, they've all got some sort of interest with the pharmaceutical industry. The only folks, that we're really, that we're really sort of perplexed about and we're, it bothers us is that the no side was able to scare some of the veterans groups into opposing this measure. We do have vote vets supporting our side of the measure, but they basically have tried to frighten the veterans into thinking that this measure somehow would impact the prices that are paid by the Department of Veteran Affairs, when actually those prices are protected by statute. So it's a really sort of a sad state that they're using veterans to try and make their case.
What's at stake for the big pharma companies if it does pass November 8th, Proposition 61? Is this kind of referendum or law likely to spread around the country? How much interest has your group received in trying to figure out how a similar law could be proposed and approved in their state all across the country? Have you gotten a lot of inquiries about that?
We have, and in fact, there are a couple of places like Illinois and Ohio which are looking at these measures as well. And the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which is the principal sponsor of this measure, has an active presence in some of those states and are looking at putting something on the ballot in other states as well. But let me just sort of go back. It's funny because the no side, whenever they talk about this measure with their campaigns, they try to use scare tactics and fear mongering to sort of try and scare people into voting against this. But when they talk to themselves, they tell you exactly what's at stake. And I'm going to read something to you from the Pharmaceutical Executive magazine, pharmaexec.com, in which they call Proposition 61 ground zero for American prescription price controls. They say basically that the question is really, what would price controls look like if they took hold in the United States? They answer that by saying it can be summed up in one word, California, because the state of California, they say, is now poised to serve as ground zero in the massive battle that will ultimately determine whether or not prescription price controls will be implemented anytime soon in California. And they say, here's the point, that if the voters of California approve Proposition 61, it would establish an incredibly deep mandatory discount, in essence, a price control for the public purchase of prescription drugs in America's largest state. And this is what they really fear. They say that such an action would no doubt cause an immediate demand for the same VA discount rate to be made available to other states, the federal government, and likely private entities as well. So in short, they say that adoption of a VA pricing system by the state of California would be a pricing disaster for the entire U.S. drug industry. So this is what they fear most. They recognize that this is going to push down drug prices. They recognize that this is going to cut into their massive profits, and that's why they're spending so much money to try to defeat it.
That was Roger Salazar, a spokesperson for California's Yes on 61 campaign. Learn more about the Proposition 61 ballot question by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
My dear friends, brothers, sisters, colleagues, and comrades of the 2016-2017 cohort of the Davis Putter Scholarship Fund, to Andrea Flores, this year's Jesse Lloyd O'Connor Scholar, congratulations. To Tara Belcher, this year's Marilyn Buck Award recipient, congratulations. To Zizi Bandera, Lydia X.C. Brown, Johnny Buck, Lindsay Chen, Luz Flores, Jessica Gonzalez, Amra Salomon Johnson, Cyre Jarrell Johnson, Lupe Salameron, David Lamas, Mariana Luna, Jake Mayer, Marco Mu Maldonado, Mala Maya, Charisse Morris, Andrea Perez, Claudia Perez, Jason Perez, Leslie Quintanilla, Lubna Kutami, Dashamel Robinson, Nancy Udine, Elizabeth Vega, the winner of the Anne Braden Award, Ash Stevens, and Gisela Zuniga. To you all, congratulations. It is rare to congratulate one at the start of a race, but of course, this is different. All of you are parts of social justice movements, and as such, we are all not at the starting line, but in the middle of the race for freedom, justice, liberation, the formation of a new world. For that, I congratulate you all. And I also want to thank the Davis Putter Scholarship Fund for its noble support of activist scholars like us all. As we begin or continue our studies, we seek to repay Davis Putter by working with more energy and clarity in our various movements to make the world a more loving, more just, more free space in which to learn, grow, and become. Again, I congratulate you all and join you all to say thank you, and let's get started. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. You're an activist. You're involved in social justice, social change. What you want to know is Davis Putter Scholarship Fund. Davis Putter cares about activists and movements and social change. And if you want to take some time to learn, to go to school, to study. You want to know Davis Putter. Contact Davis Putter, P-U-T-T-E-R, .org. And make a change. And make social change. For us all. Thank you. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Thank you. Next order of business is introduction of bills and resolutions. And the chair recognizes Councilwoman Blackwell.
Thank you, Mr. President. Today I introduce one privileged resolution co-sponsored by myself and Councilwoman Bass.
Thank you, Councilwoman.
A non-privileged resolution calling upon Governor Wolf and the Pennsylvania State Legislature to ensure that individuals incarcerated and working in state prisons have access to clean water and proper health services.
Next week's final passes count.
Pam Africa. Commenting on 160923.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to thank Councilwoman Janie Blackwell and Cindy Bass and for introducing this resolution. And I'd like to thank the power of the word, W-U-R-D 900, for helping to expose the injustices that's happening in the prison. And for over a year and a half, I've been investigating the water in the prisons. And, you know, I've been given the runaround for a while. The water inside the prisons, and I'm speaking especially right now on Gaithersburg, which I had a copy of a newspaper article that talks about the dangers of the water that is causing cancer, destroying inmates' reproductive organs, and a whole list of things that's happening. And in Gaithersburg Prison, in order for inmates to drink clean water, they got to buy it. In Mahanoy Prison, come to find out that each prisoner is given 3 cups of water 3 times a day. The water is black and it's oily and it's causing dangerous skin diseases, and people are also dying from the water. In Frackville Prison, the water, each inmate is given 1 gallon of water a day. And all this is a war crime. Water is the necessity of life. On 2020, a few months ago, an inmate, and as it was coming in, and Mr. Wetzel was bringing him through, an inmate ran in front of the camera, and he said, an elder, he said, you got to help us. The water smells like goose poop and chlorine bleach. He said, we're dying in here. We're dying from the water. And our inmates in there who have got to wash and clean themselves, who have sores and things on them, is suffering from this. They can't clean themselves, so they're getting heavily infected. I've also, it speaks about the diseases in the prison. And I want to especially talk about hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a disease that affects the liver, and in order for you, the protocol for the prison is one that states that in order for you to get the hepatitis C cure, you would have to be bleeding from the vessels in your chest, you would have to be bleeding from your esophagus, or the majority of your liver would have to be calcified with cirrhosis of the liver. This is a horrible, torturesome disease that is happening, and from the statistics, because I do investigative work, is up to 7,000 inmates who have active hepatitis C. In order for you to get the cure, and or you would have to be on a list, and the following description that I gave is where you would have to be. I'm concerned because I have a brother named Mumia Abu-Jamal in Mahanoy. I have a brother by the name of Eddie Africa. And in the other prisons, I have other inmates and all who have this, you know, that is suffering under this. 10 seconds. Thank you, Councilwoman Blackwell, because you could, she's petitioning Governor Wolf to do something about that. Thank you for the power of the word, WURD 900. And long live John Africa for giving us the strength to stand before you and deliver.
Thank you so much for your testimony, ma'am. Mr. Decker, 160923.
A resolution calling upon Governor Wolf and the Pennsylvania State Legislature to ensure that individuals incarcerated and working in state prisons have access to clean water and proper health services.
And this here recognizes Councilwoman Blackwell.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for the adoption of the resolution.
It's been moved and properly second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, ayes have it. And resolution 160923 is adopted.
Where does Washington fit into the CETA agreement, which is supposedly a free trade agreement between Canada and the European Union? How does CETA intersect with NAFTA to generate a NAFTA-EU economic alliance under corporate rule? Does the CETA agreement violate the Canadian Constitution? How could an agreement on trade and investment interfere with the operations of Canada's central bank and the way the country finances public interest enterprises? How would monopolies and crown corporations in Canada be affected by this deal? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we explore the ramifications of the latest major international trade deal known as CETA, the Canada-EU Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, which is feverishly being pursued in the face of high-profile resistance from citizens in Europe and Canada, and until recently, from one small district in Belgium. We'll hear opinions from constitutional lawyer Rocco Galati and former parliamentarian and political activist Paul Hellyer, who tabled a constitutional challenge of CETA. We'll also hear from Professor Michel Chosadovsky, who argues that CETA is a proxy for NAFTA-EU integration. On this week's program, Stop CETA, analysis from Michel Chosadovsky, Rocco Galati's constitutional challenge. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 28th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. NATO's show of force is largely in response to Moscow's decision to dispatch warships to Russia's Tartus naval base on Syria's eastern Mediterranean coastline. The propaganda ploy led by Britain's tabloids point to quote-unquote Russian aggression in Syria following the dispatch of the Kuznetsov aircraft carrier from the Baltic Sea to Syria's eastern Mediterranean coastline. President Putin sent a fleet of 8 Russian warships through the English Channel to assist the assault on the besieged Syrian city, says the Daily Mail. What the report fails to mention is that parts of Aleppo are in the hands of al-Qaeda terrorists who are supported and financed by U.S., NATO, and its Middle East allies. Russia's naval deployment is largely motivated by Washington's stated intent to establish a no-fly zone over Syria, which could lead to direct military confrontation between U.S., NATO, and Syria and Russia. That comes from the article, "The Russians Are Coming. War Propaganda Goes into High Gear, Renewed NATO Military Deployments on Russia's Doorstep," by Professor Michel Chosadovsky, posted October 27th. Russia has made it clear that they will not tolerate another Iraq in Syria. They will support the Assad regime and not allow the U.S. to overthrow yet another Middle Eastern government. Russia insists the U.S. is intentionally trying to promote anarchy in Syria by destroying the country, maintaining brutal sanctions that only harm innocents, and giving quote-unquote moderates heavy weapons to help bring down Assad. Russia has drawn a line in the sand, and Ms. Clinton is showing a severe lack of judgment in provoking and blaming them for all that ails the world. She has even compared Putin to Hitler, which historically is tantamount to declaring war. That comes from the article, "Hillary Clinton is Playing with Thermonuclear Fire and You Will Be Glowing," by Joe Clifford, posted October 26th. The most liberal presidential candidate still running, Green Party candidate Jill Stein, says, quote, "It should be clear to everyone that a vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote for war. Under Hillary Clinton, we could very quickly slide into nuclear war with her declared policy on Syria. I call for a peace offensive," unquote. And it's interesting indeed that the neocons who got us into the Iraq war have endorsed Clinton instead of Trump. That comes from the article, "Fact Check: Trump is Right That Clinton Might Trigger World War III," by Washington's blog, posted October 27th. Stopping the U.S. war on Syria requires that U.S. activists actively educate and focus on the U.S. role so that people can be agitated into action and mobilized by the tens of thousands. The principal pox on both houses approach leads in practice to inaction, making it an empty phrase when what is needed is a concrete strategy for effective on-the-ground organizing. The essence of a revolutionary internationalist approach to anti-war strategy was summarized by Leon Trotsky when he said, quote, "In the struggle against imperialism and war, the basic principle is the chief enemy is in your own country," unquote. The quote is a guide to action for those living in imperialist countries, and the U.S. remains the world's foremost imperialist country. That comes from the article, "Military Escalation in the Wake of the U.S. Presidential Elections, Stopping Hillary's Coming War on Syria," by Seamus Cook, posted October 27th. The first shadow government, referred to as COG, or Continuity of Government, is made up of unelected individuals who have been appointed to run the government in the event of a catastrophe. When and if COG takes over, the police state will transition to martial law. Yet it is the second shadow government, also referred to as the deep state, that poses the greater threat to freedom right now. Comprised of unelected government bureaucrats, corporations, contractors, paper pushers, and button pushers who are actually calling the shots behind the scenes, this government within a government is the real reason we, the people, have no real control over our government. The deep state, which operates according to its own compass heading, regardless of who is formally in power, makes a mockery of elections and the entire concept of a representative government. That comes from the article, The Path to Total Dictatorship, America's Shadow Government and Its Silent Coup, by John W. Whitehead, posted October 26th, originally appearing at the Rutherford Institute. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. There's one aspect of the Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement that's seldom examined, even by critics, and that is how CETA interfaces with NAFTA. Professor Michel Chalcedovsky, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and the founder and director of the Centre for Research on Globalization, argues that the two agreements work together to form a de facto NAFTA-EU-Atlantic economic trading bloc with severe ramifications for the citizens of the member countries. To explain this point further, Professor Chalcedovsky joins us now from Montreal. Good morning, Professor Chalcedovsky.
Yes, good morning.
So, International Trade Minister Chrystia Freeland has spoken of the agreement between Canada and the EU as a contract between like-minded societies embracing liberal or social democratic values. So it would come as a surprise to many that this is an initiative directed from Washington. Could you explain exactly how the U.S. is involved and active behind the scenes?
Well, first of all, we have to address the broader scenario of the trade agreements which are being negotiated. With regard to North America, there were three bilateral projects with the European Union, respectively by Mexico, the United States, and Canada. The main trade agreement was a TTIP, in other words, bilateral relationship between the United States and the European Union, which was, of course, the object of controversy and ultimately is stalled. When we look at the CETA agreement, in other words, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement between Canada and the European Union, we have to understand that Canada and the United States are integrated into a North American free trade area, NAFTA, which has extensive clauses with regard to trade and investment, intellectual property rights, financial services, etc., and that a bilateral agreement between Canada and the European Union will eventually trigger the integration of NAFTA and the European Union from the trade and investment point of view, but very broadly, even politically, leading to what I would call the North Atlantic Trade and Investment Area, NATIA. That concept is not official, but that's what I would describe it as being, a trading bloc broadly coinciding, and that's very important, with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And mind you, the Asian component, the Asia-Pacific component, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, has also a similar logic. It's the integration of it's the integration of Pacific nations and Southeast Asian countries within the realm of not only a trade and investment framework, but it's also a geopolitical and strategic alignment, ultimately also directed against China. And as we know, that China has put forth this concept of One Belt, One Road, which is the Eurasian project. So that you have essentially two major trading blocks, which are an initiative of Washington. It's an imperial project, which broadly coincide with the structure of military alliances, and which, from the outset, exclude both the Russian Federation, the Middle East, Iran, and of course, China. So that's the geopolitical context. But what I'm saying with regard to Canada-EU relations is that this, in essence, is not a bilateral agreement. You've got 28 countries on the one hand, the European Union, and then you've got one country on the other, and not a major country, Canada, 36 million people. Okay, it's a backdoor mechanism. In other words, I consider that the CETA agreement presented to public opinion as an innocuous bilateral EU-Canada trade deal constitutes a TTIP in disguise. And that what it means is it has all the major clauses of the trade agreements, going back to the WTO. Commodity trade, trade in services, investment, intellectual property, financial services, and then, of course, legal provisions which allow corporations to overshadow the sovereignty of national governments, and so on and so forth. And it is impossible for Canada to enter into a bilateral agreement without it ultimately leading to a subsequent stage, which is the integration of the United States with the European Union to form that project. The project is a trading bloc. It's the Atlantic trading bloc. And the strategy was to implement that trading bloc through bilateral agreements rather than a full-fledged agreement which would be NAFTA, European Union, which politically would not have been accepted by the member states of the European Union.
Is it possible you could give us a concrete illustration of what you're talking about? Like, say, you're as a European community, district, or whatever. How would the U.S. presumably be involved in terms of undermining what's happening there?
Well, I think to answer that question, you have to go back to the Bush versus, it was during the Harper period, during the Conservative government in Canada, that these things were put together, okay? And it's part of foreign policy broadly. No, it's an economic project, but it's part of U.S., Canada foreign policy, and during the Harper the Harper government, we had very much a copy and paste with regard to broad initiatives of this nature, and I don't have the record. We may have to go back and look at the historical record as to how it was decided by the member states of the North America. The North American Free Trade Area, namely the United States, Canada, and Mexico, that they decided to have to implement these three bilateral initiatives. And eventually these three bilateral initiatives would merge, and there we reach the final objective, which is the imperial project of creating a North Atlantic trading bloc, dollarized, of course. It eventually will lead to the dollarization of that bloc and the European monetary system, which is already, ultimately, is already dollarized. The Eurozone would merge with the dollar zone. And then I pointed to the fact that we would really be integrating countries which belong to the same military alliance, which is the North the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
So I know that the United Kingdom has apparently voted for Brexit, so they're they seem to be moving out of the European Union. And yet, I mean, you talk about this convergence with NATO. I'm wondering what the UK's Brexit referendum would mean if that is the case. I mean, does that frustrate things in, or the planning in any way?
Well,
or how does the European Union respond in the face of that kind of that disconnect?
Well, you know, if we look at it in broader terms, historically there is an Anglo-American alliance which has existed. I say it has existed since World War II. In fact, it has existed for much longer than that. I would say probably going back to the late 19th century with the foundation of the Council of Foreign Relations and so on. But that axis, that Anglo-American axis, is still there. And it's if there's going to be a North Atlantic trade and investment area, the Anglo-American axis would ultimately be dominant. I mean, the UK is very much also, let's say the UK government has its sovereignty, but it's very closely aligned with the United States with regard to foreign policy and with regard to economic issues. The defense industry, British Aerospace, is part of the Anglo-American defense contractors. It's registered in the United States, and weapons trade is, of course, very, very important. Okay, we see it. It's part of both the strategic landscape and the economic landscape. We see Britain selling to Saudi Arabia, Canada. Is also selling weapons, but inevitably they are by companies which are in fact ultimately North American, because it's a Canadian counterpart of a U.S. Weapons producer. So again, I see the Anglo-American axis as being the dominant partner within a broader North Atlantic structure, and they are also dominant within NATO. Ultimately, they're a very powerful voice in NATO, and that powerful voice in NATO is ultimately also in liaison with Washington.
There's been a lot of convergence within Canada, the United States, and Mexico on an energy policy and regulations and defense and economically. And so I'm wondering, with this, should the Canada-EU Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement successfully go through, what does that do to just within North America? Does it enhance the existing alignments, and how exactly?
Well, I think those alignments are ongoing. I certainly would see that if, let's say, the European Union is integrated into a North Atlantic trading bloc, that structures of governance, let's say, let's use the term governance, is a very sort of popular term. The structures of governance would evolve, and you would possibly have four centers of power: Brussels, Ottawa, Mexico, and Washington. With Washington acting as the highest level of governance in that political, economic, and strategic structure. Okay. With NATO and the North Atlantic trade and investment area, etc. So you, I think that we'd have certain levels of governance. And then the other tendency, which has been ongoing, I would say, since the mid-90s, is what I'd call, and I use those terms at that time, the North American states and provinces. Well, I'm sorry, it's the United States
and provinces,
Of North America. The United States and provinces of North America. So it's a North American structure where you have provinces and you have states, and ultimately it leads to what some people have called Fortress North America. That process is ongoing, and it's ongoing very gradually. You can see it in terms of defense agreements, the fact that Canada was ultimately, under the Liberal government of Jean Chrétien, they refused to join Northern Command. Okay, Northern Command was set up by Rumsfeld just immediately after 9/11, and it encroached on Canadian sovereignty, because Rumsfeld said Northern Command will have its jurisdiction extends from the Caribbean up to the Northern Territories. Okay. And nobody actually contested it, but the Liberal government said, no, we're not going to join that. And then they created sort of a transition body, which was not part of Northern Command, but which was Canadian, and which interfaced with Northern Command. And now, de facto, we're members of Northern Command, and we have joint command structures, Canada-US. And in the area, in the spheres of economics and trade, the same thing with regard to corporate structures. And we see our financial institutions, let's say TD Canada Trust is the seventh largest, I think it's among the 10 largest financial institutions in the United States. Okay? We still have our sovereignty in terms of banking, and that's a very important issue, Canadian banks. We don't have foreign banks coming into the landscape. But I think that is going to evolve. And so we are, in fact, moving towards a structure which we might describe as the United States and provinces of North America. And you can see it even when you go online and you order something online, and it says states, provinces, all the same, you know, and then you click. As if, you know, we are really part of that appendage. So I would say we're going to have different levels of governance. Brussels, Ottawa, Washington, Mexico City, and beneath that we'll have the member states of the European Union. And we will have the governments of the provinces and the states in North America, and that's the hierarchy. And then eventually, those political entities are then subsequently then members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I mean that's the way I see that evolving. It's already happening.
Could I get maybe, because we're running a little bit out of time, I was wondering if you could maybe just give us a quick opinion, because I know you're arguably one of the world's foremost authorities on globalization, and I'm wondering where CETA fits into that larger trajectory of neoliberal globalization that we've seen over the last few decades.
Well, the thing is that the clauses in CETA are very similar to the clauses in all the other trade agreements. Okay, there's a certain pattern with regard, essentially, to trade. Well, trade is not the major issue. Investment, national treatment, intellectual property, the legal apparatus, and so on and so forth. You have that kind of architecture in all these trade agreements. And in a sense, they are built on the structures, or they extend the structures of the World Trade Organization. And I should say that the World Trade Organization is an illegal entity because it was never ratified by the parliaments, and that people forget that. Up to this date, it's still an illegal entity. Now, what I'm saying with regard to the movement against CETA, that I think the movement against CETA has to be also formulated in a much broader framework. It's also a movement against imperialism, against an imperial project, and it should be understood that CETA eventually leads to the integration of NAFTA and the European Union. And that, of course, that's maybe much more important for the Europeans, because they don't realize ultimately that that's what's going to happen. It's not a relationship between the European Union and a country of 36 million people. Okay, it eventually leads to the integration of these two major trading blocks.
Well, Professor Chostadovsky, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but thanks as always for your thoughts and analysis on these extremely concerning developments.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
We've been speaking with Professor Michel Chostadovsky. He is the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization and Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa. And you can find his commentaries at globalresearch.ca.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA, has, as this program goes to air, cleared the various roadblocks with hesitant EU countries, including, most recently, Belgium, and is now on a path to ratification within days, or so we are led to believe if we follow the mainstream media in Canada. On Friday, October 21st, Canadian constitutional lawyer Rocco Galotti filed a statement of claim against Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the Government of Canada, arguing that the CETA violates and undermines the Canadian Constitution. Galotti, along with Anne Emmett and the Honorable Paul Hellyer, the clients on whose behalf he is filing the claim, appeared at a press conference on Tuesday, October 25th, to explain the substance of the claim. Global Research participated in the conference by phone. The following is some of the audio from that press conference.
Rocco Galotti, to my left is the Honorable Paul Hellyer, and to his left, Anne Emmett. We're here today to announce the filing of a constitutional challenge on last Friday, October the 21st, against the CETA, the trade accord with between Canada and the European Union. The challenge is based on four major prongs, and that is that first, that the federal executive does not have the constitutional authority to unilaterally bind the country without the treaty going through Parliament first and being enacted. And even if it were enacted through Parliament, even Parliament cannot encroach on exclusive provincial rights and other constitutional rights that are not the exclusive purview of the federal Parliament. The second challenge is that the majority of the terms of the CETA actually encroach on exclusive provincial rights such as natural resources, education, health, property and civil rights, the licensing of professionals, the qualifications of professionals. Those are all exclusive provincial jurisdiction. And this treaty, in its opening chapter, in Chapter 2, the executive undertakes to make sure that all levels of government, including the provinces and the municipalities, comply with the treaty, which, of course, the federal executive nor federal parliament have the constitutional jurisdiction to do. Thirdly, what the treaty does is set up a foreign tribunal to adjudicate disputes between private corporations and the government of Canada, when private corporations cannot engage in the business they want to engage in because a province or other entity which has exclusive jurisdiction over the matter says no, then we as Canadians have to compensate that company. So what that does in effect is it eliminates the pivotal lever of what maintains our constitutional democracy, and that's a fair and independent judiciary. So what we have is we have a tribunal that's going to sit in Ottawa when the dispute is heard, deciding issues of Canadian property, Canadian rights, and Canadian constitutional rights, but is beyond the reach or judicial review of Canadian courts. And lastly, what the CETA provisions do is eliminate subsidies, monopolies, and state enterprises that are there for the benefit of maintaining social welfare and economic programs for public welfare. And basically, this treaty, virtually all of it, covers every single social program. The only three exceptions in the treaty are national security, taxation, and cultural industries. So everything else is up for grabs for private exploitation by foreign corporations, overriding the Constitution of Canada and overriding the rights and of Canadian citizens who are resident here. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hellyer before answering any questions.
Title of this little five-minute expose I have is entitled Why I Am 100% Opposed to CETA. And I guess in one line, it would be to save the Prime Minister from making the biggest mistake that any Prime Minister has made in the 67 years since I first set foot in Ottawa. But then, to refine that a little bit, there are two profound reasons for opposing the ratification of CETA. First, it would be illegal. It would result in a unilateral change in the Constitution of Canada. And that is outside the power of both the government and Parliament. The second reason is that to ratify CETA would be monstrously immoral. It would be the biggest betrayal of Canadian rights and privileges in the history of the country. Not only would it give foreign banks and corporations greater rights in Canada than those enjoyed by Canadian citizens, which is indescribably wrong, in my opinion, it would give foreign bankers an effective veto over use of our most valuable financial asset, the Bank of Canada, at the very moment when we need it most. The situation today is reminiscent of the 1930s. In 1938, there were no jobs in Canada, none. Then the war came along, and pretty soon everybody was working, either in the armed forces or building factories or making munitions. And you say, where did the government get the money to accelerate growth to this extent, to do these things? The answer is that the Bank of Canada printed it. P-R-I-N-T-E-D, it. The money creation function was shared between the government of Canada and the private banks. This system was maintained after the war and helped pay for our large infrastructure projects. The St. Lawrence Seaway, the Trans-Canada Highway, the distant early warning line, some of you may not remember, but there was a line of radar stations built all around the periphery of the continent, very expensive, and the Bank of Canada helped the Government of Canada to pay for that installation, as well as to help us pay for a very comprehensive and much admired social security system. All of this was accomplished without significant borrowing and with inflation in line with other OECD countries. Then in 1974, the governor of the Bank of Canada abandoned the needs of his shareholders and started taking his orders from the Bank for International Settlements that is controlled by the elite international banking cartel. The result for Canada is that because we had to then borrow in the market from fiscal year 74-75 to 2013-14, we had to pay $1.17 trillion, that's trillion dollars, in interest on debt, almost all of it unnecessary. All of that, plus decades of underfunding for all of our essential services. We switched from prosperity to austerity, and the international banking cartel ended up with a monopoly over money creation. Well, all of this has to be reversed. The Canadian government gives the Parliament of Ottawa the absolute right to create or to have the Bank of Canada create all of the money necessary to meet the legitimate needs of the Canadian people. And as an aside, we need an infrastructure bank. Canada needs an infrastructure bank like it needs a hole in the head. We don't need it because we have one. And it worked from 39 to 74, 35 years. It worked like a charm, gave us the best 35 years of the century. And all we have to do is learn from history and do something similar again. Well, in fact, there is a plan called a social contract between the government and people of Canada, which is available to Parliament now. And this plan calls for the creation of $150 billion a year for 7 years to be split between Ottawa and the provinces and territories on a per capita basis. But if CETA were ratified and implemented, prosperity would never be restored, nor the backlog of needs met, because European banks would sue Canada for tens or hundreds of billions of dollars if we denied them the opportunity to lend us the money and buy up our real assets for 5 cents on the dollar and keep us in poverty forever. The war between the rich and the poor that the rich have been winning would be over. So CETA must not only wither on the vine, but die on the vine and become nothing more than a footnote to history.
A single article about the filing of the constitutional challenge appeared in the media courtesy of a report by Canadian Press. The Canadian Press article quoted a constitutional law expert from the University of Ottawa, Errol Mendes, as saying that Galati was mistaken about the claim that the federal government cannot sign and ratify trade deals without parliamentary consent, saying, quote, "It's basic 101 constitutional law that the federal government has the right to sign and ratify international treaties under the royal prerogative," Galati responded.
The fact of the matter is that prior to the Harper government engaging in negotiations on the CETA, the Parliamentary Research Library was asked to do a paper on the source of the constitutional authority for signing treaties, of which I have a copy, because this is the third time I've raised this issue in the court since 1998, and the first two times it did not get resolved by the courts to its conclusion. What that research paper from Parliament, which was floated to the government, states is that this whole notion of constitutional authority to sign treaties by the executive is in flux, and they stand on the old pre-patriation notion of residual crown prerogative back in the days when Westminster in England, the executive, Her Majesty the Queen, used to sign these treaties on behalf of all the dominions. That evolved in 1935 to allowing the Governor General as her designee here in Canada to sign on behalf of Canada. What's happened in my view, and with all due respect to Professor Mendes, who's probably never thought about it, is that the patriation of the Constitution extinguishes residual crown prerogative, which is the power in the Queen to exercise power that Parliament or the Constitution has not taken over. The House of Lords in England has made it clear that Her Majesty the Queen has no more role in Canada. So In 1998, in a case called Fogel that went to the federal court where the same issue was being litigated, the government moved to strike the claim based on the fact that this was a frivolous argument, this idea that the executive didn't have the right to sign international treaties. The court refused to strike it on that basis, and in the written judgment said, whether or not Crown prerogative still exists after the repatriation of the Constitution in 1982 is a serious question to be resolved. The court didn't hear the case because in the context of multilateral agreement on investment, which was the case, the agreement was not ultimately signed by the Canadian government nor the other 28 OECD countries, and therefore the case, the court decided they weren't going to hear it because there was no treaty. However, on the issue that we're putting before the federal court has already decided that this old notion of whether or not Crown prerogative exists to give the executive the authority to bind Canada this way is a serious question to be determined by the court. Now, is there a guarantee we'll win? No, but I stand firm on the representation that we're on solid legal ground here. You cannot have the executive knowingly sign away provincial rights with respect to provincial programs and provincial property in Canada and have a foreign body come to Canada and decide the rights of the province and of Canadian citizens under domestically, including constitutional issues, and not have our courts have a say in it. I mean, how ludicrous is that?
And if I might add, the same argument applies to federal rights, including the unlimited jurisdiction of the Parliament of Canada over money and banking, which would be compromised by the treaty and would be, in effect, rendered ineffective so that we couldn't use an asset which is our most precious financial asset in the whole country.
What CETA does through the back door is it allows foreign banks and insurance companies the right to say, well, Bank of Canada can't have any more say in the private banking industry because that infringes our treaty rights to compete with private banks. And so here you have a public institution, a public bank, set up by an act of parliament that has to take a back seat to the treaty rights of private corporations. It's completely ludicrous. Listen, just to draw you an analogy, what's happening here is that if you think about the irony that we patriated our Constitution in 1982, what this treaty does, and any treaty of this magnitude does, is literally revert us back to the rule of divine rule of kings. The only exception is they're not on thrones now. They're in a numbered company that floats around the universe and around the planet, and every government and every constitution has to take a back seat to these corporations. And they affect this not through democratic process in Canada at any rate, by passing it through parliament and consulting citizens and seeing if it's constitutionally permissible, but they simply do it by executive fiat. They get together in private and in secret for 8 years. They present a text. This is the main text of the CETA right here. If I had printed the annexes with all the products and details, it would be 7-8 times as high. And so we get this, and they say, we're signing it, and now the country and the Constitution and the Canadian citizens are bound just by executive fiat. Well, it's not an exaggeration to say in another time and place, that's the same as saying, l'état, c'est moi. You know, the prime minister saying, I am the state.
I'd like to put a question to you about further on this point about Crown prerogative.
Now, if you're talking about the fact that the Prime Minister cannot invoke the crown or royal prerogative in signing treaties, that has implications not just for CETA, it seems to me, but for every trade agreement that's been signed by Harper over the last, and or for that matter, even NAFTA.
Well, to the extent that Parliament didn't later ratify through an act of Parliament, yes. But to answer your question, if Parliament has ratified it, the courts may say, well, that cured the problem. However, when you look at the terms of NAFTA, they still suffer from the same unconstitutional provisions that Mr. Hellyer and I have been talking about, and that is they encroach on provincial rights, the judicial mechanism for determining Canadian rights on Canadian soil under the Canadian law and constitution is decided upon by a foreign body not subject to our judiciary. And there's the other aspect of our challenge, too, that is a bit more difficult for people to try to grasp their mind around. We also say that it is unconstitutional for our Parliament, even, to grant a fictitious foreign non-entity domestic rights and international rights which trump the rights of legislatures and statutes. This was tried from 1608 to 1970. In 1608, Lord Cook, they tried it in a case called Sutton's Hospital. The English court said you can't give a corporation existence out of the domestic country from where it's created. And they tried it all the way off and on. Adam Smith said this was a crazy idea. In the World Court in 1970, the World Court rejected this argument that a corporation can exert existence in more than one jurisdiction, the jurisdiction where it's created. And so what you have, you see it, what you have is you have these new, this new royalty of multinational corporations governing, and you get the result. You get the, and they have a Panamanian bank account, and they have, that's, you know, you see the result of the system. And people and constitutions around the world are supposed to take a back seat to this. This is insane.
I might add, if we don't crush CETA, then we'll turn around twice and we'll be faced with the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right,
which is even worse and presumably has a bigger text.
And could you comment on, other actions involving Crown prerogative, like deploying troops abroad? You're essentially arguing that even that is invalidated unless it gets prior or eventual approval by Parliament?
I've argued that in the perimeter fence case. Listen, everybody, you know, there's an old bad joke that a lot of lawyers, jurists, and law professors have only two operating parts, and I say that's partly true, but I like to talk out of my mouth because it's closer to my brain. Others like to talk from the other end. The executive does not have the constitutional authority, and I filed against Prime Minister Chrétien when this happened in Kosovo. The executive, contrary to what Professor Mendez says, does not have the unilateral constitutional right to send troops abroad. The sending of troops abroad and or the use of the military in Canada, we also challenged it at the Gufferson Lake uprising in B.C., are governed by the Emergencies Act, which is the new version of the War Measures Act. Under the law, all military excursions, whether they be domestic or international, have to be through the Emergencies Act. When you send troops abroad under the Emergencies Act, there has to be a parliamentary committee of all the parties in the House that oversees the operations 24/7, and then after the emergency is done with, has to issue a report to Parliament and report whether or not the use of force was justified. Now, of course, you know, laws in the Constitution are very inconvenient these days. So people think, oh, the Governor General is the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, therefore the Governor General can do what he or she wants. No. And, you know, the prohibition against putting sending soldiers out on the streets the way they did in Gufferson Lake contravenes the English Bill of Rights, which is still part of our Constitution, that you cannot, in peacetime, quarter an army and use an army on your own people. It's unconstitutional. The fact that these things happen and the fact that they're not challenged or that the courts haven't adjudicated doesn't mean that they're legal. And so Professor Mendez is wrong on that point, drawing that analogy on that point. The other thing I'd like to say is, and we make this clear in the statement of claim, is that if you look at treaties that stem from the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government, when a treaty is signed by the federal government where it's the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government, like, for instance, criminal law, those treaties are only signed pursuant to acts of Parliament. For instance, extradition treaties have to comply with the Extradition Act. The mutual assistance for taking of evidence and executing search warrants is similar. There's an act there. The return of children when they're kidnapped by one of the parents under a family law dispute, there's a Hague Convention for the return of children. Now, the federal government signed that, but it's funny, it's the exclusive jurisdiction of the province. It has no force in Canada unless the provincial parliaments pass it under their family law legislation. Ontario has passed it, but because it's the exclusive jurisdiction of the province, custody and access, it has to see approval and enactment by the province. With trade deals, they don't do this because it's inconvenient. They know very well that they're trampling and stomping on jurisdiction that's not theirs. So they fall back on this quaint right of divine rule that goes back to Versailles and Napoleon as their basis, literally. Residual crown prerogative. Well, just try to break that down. It said what that means is we can rule over provincial and federal parliaments at whim. Well, where do we see this before? Certainly not in any modern post-1867 constitutional framework. So we're literally regressing to the notion that they can simply govern by fiat, royal fiat at that. When our monarch says you're on your own in 1982, I have nothing left to say in Canada. So analyze that.
And on that, on the issue of encroaching on exclusive jurisdiction, I mean, like, there's been several lawsuits already under NAFTA, and one example, Quebec banning of fracking,
right?
And that's being challenged. I mean, I'm wondering, based on what you're saying, one could argue that Quebec could just comfortably ignore this. I mean, even if you're signed on to these agreements, one could challenge the ability to or challenge lawsuits on that basis going forward. No,
no, no, no. You're missing the point here, Michael. No, Quebec can tell any company get lost, and the feds don't have a say over it. If they say no fracking, no fracking, except that the company who wants to come in to frack had intended to make $250 million. So the lawsuit is not against Quebec. It's against the federal government and the taxpayers of Canada who will have to pay that $250 million because Canada, in not being able to force Quebec to comply with the treaty rights, is in breach of the treaty. You understand?
Mm-hmm. But CETA does apply to subnational levels of government.
You're wrong. It's in the statement of claim. Chapter 2, Section 2, Sub 2, says that the federal government undertakes to ensure that the objectives and the enforcement of the treaty is implemented by all levels of government, including provincial and municipal. And I'm basically quoting almost verbatim. So the federal government is going out there and saying, I promise that everybody in Canada, including the provinces, and the municipalities will comply with the treaty, knowing full well they have, one, no business promising that because it's unconstitutional, and two, no way in enforcing that because it's unconstitutional.
On the behalf of Canadian Bank Reform, I just want to ask a basic question for the general public that's out there who aren't very educated on this data and the effects that it can have on their lives if it's passed. So can you bring up maybe some solid bullet points on how it's going to directly affect their lives?
the government will no longer be, the provincial governments will no longer be able to, without penalty to the federal government, give subsidies for health care, education, all the social programs that you see municipally in terms of, you know, community programs, welfare, and all of that. Okay? If they do so, then the federal government, if it breaches a right, will have to pay. So how does the federal government avoid paying because the provinces won't let them do it? Well, behind the scenes, the federal government will use their spending power to say to the provinces, look, if you don't play ball on this, we'll cut our transfer payments to you for education and health. That's been how they've been able to implement the NAFTA when it's encroaching on provincial rights. So expect exorbitant utility bills, hydro, you've already seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Expect a cutting of educational program, a cutting of health benefits, on and on and on. So education, health, social programs, roads too, because private corporations will be able to compete with the government. It used to be that the government built highways. Now they're going to come in and privatize the roads, bridges, on and on.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.